You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege this week to welcome to Talk Nation Radio Ana Maria Gower, who is a Serbian-British mixed-media artist focusing on the themes of memories, life path, and experiences of war. The origin of her artistic interests goes back to her own experience of surviving the NATO bombings of Yugoslavia and its capital, Belgrade. Being a 10-year-old in a war zone, she witnessed the destruction caused by NATO involvement, both during the conflict and for years after. A graduate of Central Saint Martin in London, she has participated in numerous exhibitions in the UK, in Serbia, and in the United States. Currently lives and works in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she will be exhibiting her art and speaking at the No to NATO, Yes to Peace Festival this coming April in Washington, D.C. See notonato.org. Ana Maria Gower, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hi, David, and hello to all the listeners. Thank you for such a lovely introduction. I just want to say thank you for inviting me to your radio show and allowing me to talk about my art and my war experience. This is actually my first time talking publicly about myself, my art, and the war.
Well, thank you for coming on, and thank you for coming to the event coming up in April. NoToNATO.org is where people can learn about it. It's odd to be talking about visual art on the radio, of course. Can you tell people a website address if they want to see what we're talking about?
Yeah, my website is www.annamariagower.com. I'm a mixed media artist. And in my art, I talk about war a lot. It's obviously left a huge impact on me. And your view of world changes when you face almost certain death. And one of the major pieces that I'll be displaying in Washington during the No to NATO Festival is called What I Saw When I Hugged My Grandmother. It is very difficult, as you said, to describe art on the radio. However, this is one, it has a very specific story behind it.
Can you talk about that story and about what your experience was as a child in Yugoslavia?
Yes. Well, what I saw when I hugged my grandmother is definitely a piece, a very personal piece to me. And it talks about the experience that I will really never forget in my life as a child during the war. It was one night in Belgrade. And my grandmother was putting me to sleep. And I'll never forget, it was a dark night, and I was just about to close my eyes and fall asleep. And suddenly, it was a huge boom. And my bed pretty much almost touched the ceiling. And my grandmother rushed into the room, and she got all our stuff, and we tried to exit the apartment, but the apartment was shaking so much we couldn't leave the house. So we thought to wait for a little bit, maybe we'll pass, but it didn't. So we decided to leave the apartment, and the building was shaking so much that we were falling while we were running down the stairs to exit the building. We tried to go to the shelter. Unfortunately, the shelters were full, and because we didn't have a male figure in those days, we just weren't allowed to get in. So my grandmother said to me, "Okay, let's run in the field. Let's run in the open. It's you know, we have better chances of surviving." So we started running, but at some some period of time, we stopped. My grandmother stopped us, and she took my hand and she told me, I'm sorry, my child, that I can't protect you. I can't protect you anymore. I'm sorry that we're going to die. And sorry, I get really emotional when I think about the story. So I was a 10-year-old. I didn't really understand really what was going on. I understood there was destruction and chaos and bombs falling everywhere, but I still wasn't really comprehending that I might die. So I hugged my grandmother. I mean, I took her hands and I said, "Don't worry, Granny. If we die, we'll die together." And we hugged and we just stayed and field. We couldn't see anything. It was dark colors of black and red and orange and pink. You couldn't see anything. Everything was just shaking. And we just hugged and we just waited. But we were fortunate enough that we survived that night when they were trying to bomb the power plant in Belgrade. We were 500 meters, actually, my building from the power plant. So, you know, this is that story behind what I saw when I hugged my grandmother at the painting. But one thing I definitely learned from this is that war solves nothing. War makes all problems worse, and war is never the answer, really.
It's a powerful experience. When you say they were trying to bomb the power plant, who's they?
NATO. NATO, yes. NATO in 1999, they bombed ex-Yugoslavia, Serbia, and Kosovo. It started on March 24th, 1999. It lasted for 78 days, the war. I mean, obviously, it's not as long as other wars that we're aware of, but to me, it felt like a century. You know, every day was spent in fear and danger. And also the bombings were started without the UN authorization. So, yeah.
I imagine even with UN authorization, the bombs wouldn't have been very pleasant to live through.
No, absolutely not. It's definitely an experience that stays within you for the rest of your life. So, no.
When at World Beyond War, as you know, we try to make the case to people that war can never be justified. And certain people will argue, and I've done public debates with people who will argue that certain wars have been just and necessary and legitimate. And I would say in the top three, at least, recent wars that people pull out as examples of good, necessary, just wars is the war that you lived through as a 10-year-old. I imagine as you've gotten older, you've looked back at the arguments on both sides and what the greater good could possibly have been to justify the evil that you lived through. What's your understanding of the motivation and the evil or the good of that war?
Well, as I've never been on a radio before, and this topic is really important to me, I actually prepared a few general facts that I think will give our listeners a general idea of the impact that NATO bombing had on Serbia.
Great.
You know, NATO have said that their goal was not to harm civilians, but over 12,000 people were wounded and 4,000 people died during the war, of which 2,000 were innocent civilians. They destroyed bridges, public buildings, industrial plants, private businesses, TV stations, and they even bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. Over 1,000 planes went on bombing raids, and 30,000 times, in which 31,000 missiles were dropped in Serbia. And one fact that just amazes me is that NATO dropped 15 tons of depleted uranium on Serbia, from which 6 tons were uranium-238. This is a type of uranium used in atomic bombs that were dropped in Japan in 1945. Depleted uranium causes cancer and mutation. 110% more people have suffered from leukemia if you compare the period before the bombing. And between the years of 2001 and 2015, there were 330,000 cancer cases, of which 200,000 ended in death. I mean, I can keep going and going with the facts, but it's just you can imagine how much casualties this war has caused. And even actually Italian soldiers that were based in Kosovo, I believe there were 500 Italian soldiers, that suffered from cancer, 350 suffered from cancer, and 48 died. So it wasn't just the Serbian people that actually suffered. And this is a proven fact. And $130 billion of damage was made. And we didn't receive any funding or help after the war. They could have fed 80 million people for that much money that this war has caused.
And it's ongoing, right? The depleted uranium, for example, doesn't go away. It's not in the past.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. It really, really doesn't.
Anna Maria Gower, you use the facts very well, but I take it your chief medium for communicating with people is art. Were you already an artist at 10 years old? When did you become an artist?
No, I didn't, actually. I moved to Belgrade when I was actually 2 years old. I was born in ex-Yugoslavia, Croatia, in a small city called Rijeka. And my mother was Serbian, my father is Croatian. And during the early 90s, the civil war between Croatia, Bosnia, and Serbia broke out. And it was an awful war that should have never happened, but unfortunately it did. And it created a huge hatred between people, as you can imagine. And it took a toll on my parents' marriage, and they divorced. So I was left with my grandmother. She brought me up in Serbia, Belgrade. And as I was coming from a mixed marriage, and my first and last name were Croatian, she kept me low and hiding until the war ended. So as I was considered to be the enemy of the state at that time. And my grandmother was afraid that I could be harmed. So I lived in Belgrade until I was 15 years old, and then I moved to London. And this was obviously a huge cultural shock for me, and the war experience was still, in a way, definitely defining every day of my life. And I found art. This is where I actually found the way to think and express myself and my thoughts and my emotions. And I can definitely say there that art saved my life. It definitely saved my sanity.
Do you still feel sort of traumatized by the war, and does the art creation help you with that?
Yes, actually, this is something that I encourage to many students that I voluntarily teach art. I think art is very therapeutical, and it really helps people with traumas. And before, I didn't understand until no long ago why mental institutions actually have implemented art. It really does help. It's proven to help with people suffering from PTSD and trauma.
I haven't seen your art in person, but I've seen it on your website, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you bring to the No to NATO, Yes to Peace Festival. But there are, you know, beautiful artworks on your website depicting, you know, horrible things, a war-damaged, burning city you're finding beauty in, but then you're using that beautiful art to move people against war, not in favor of it. There are a lot of contradictions in this sort of process, it seems like.
Absolutely. You know, I think I'm definitely using my art to express my way of thinking. And I think that, as I said, war is never the answer to anything. And my way of demonstrating that is through my art. And I am really looking forward to coming to the No to NATO, Yes to Peace Festival. It will be held on April 3rd and 4th. And as you said, I will be one of the speakers, and I really appreciate that I'll be exhibiting some of my art pieces. And I just want to take this chance to thank Garth Smith and Greta Zara for inviting me to participate. I really, really appreciate this opportunity, as it's the first time that somebody took interest in my art, in war series.
Well, I'm very glad again that you're coming. One of the pieces that I was interested in when I saw it on your website is a portrait of a war victim, which is somewhat horrific, not beautiful. Maybe would be the first word. Did you paint war victims from particular individuals or as a general idea of a war victim? How did those come about?
Yes, I have a few pieces on war victims. Actually, in London, I have met a journalist who was on the field during the war, and he wrote a few books and documentary, and he documented all the war victims. And one of those images that I painted was actually in his book. And I think that's the one that you're talking about. And he kind of gave me an overview of the overall experience that he had as a journalist on the field during the war. And I started painting those series of the victims, but then I got kind of a negative feedback from the people. They thought it was too aggressive, and they thought it was too negative and depressing. So I kind of took it on the other side. I tried to make my art more symbolic and meaningful, hoping to, you know, get attention from everybody and try to get everyone's attention on it, as I would say.
Yeah, I don't know how to address someone who wants a more positive portrait of war victims. But in my introduction from your bio, I mentioned that you talked about the damage that NATO did during that war and for years after. Can you talk about that? Most people imagine that the United States military and NATO's militaries rush in to do their good deeds of making war and then ride off with their white hats and are done. I guess that wasn't the case in Yugoslavia.
Well, this is the thing. As I said, they bombed us without the UN authorization. And after the war, we didn't receive any help or funding. And nobody ever, you know, took a responsibility or even apologized or anything. And they're trying to make it, you know, sound that it was a humanitarian intervention, which really, to me, sounds like a really bad joke. And there was so much damage caused, not just to the country, but to the people itself. And, you know, this is something that is, in my opinion, really terrible. And people are still paying for this because the country, to start off, it's not a rich country. It's a very small country. We have about 9 million people. The population is 9 million people. So, you know, bombing a country such as Serbia, which is a small country, and leaving it in such destruction and so much, damage, $130 billion of damage, you know, you can imagine how much effect it took. And you know, during the war, I turned 11 years old on April 23rd, that day, NATO bombed the Serbian TV station, and they killed 16 journalists. And this act is actually considered by Amnesty International to be a deliberate act against civilians. It is pretty difficult to express how much torture and suffering they caused, not so to my people.
It seems like this was an early model war for NATO. That is, the wars on Afghanistan and Libya and elsewhere have followed from it. And the idea that a war being waged by NATO sort of kind of legitimizes it without the United Nations, that this muddled idea in the minds of Americans that if a war is a NATO war, it's sort of okay, as if the UN had said it was okay, it kind of originates there. Do you think that changing people's minds about the war in Yugoslavia that happened so many years ago now could help change their minds about all the subsequent wars waged by NATO and the United States?
I certainly hope so. I currently live in the United States, and I really love this country, and I have a huge respect for the American people. Even though the United States was the major force behind the attack, I don't hold any hatred towards the country. Whatever you heard about the conflict in Yugoslavia, I just want everyone to understand the military attacks, like the one organized by NATO, ruins lives of innocent people. And I really hope that never happens again. And I hope the people will understand that. And the more, we talk about it, and the more we have shows like these and Note to NATO festivals, I think it's going to bring more awareness to the public and understand that war is never the answer, and definitely, NATO has to be stopped. They cannot be bombing in the countries and killing people, without any really reason. They can't be doing that. They killed so many people and just got away with it. And, I don't come from a political aspect or anything to your show. I'm just an artist, and I hope that my message and my experience will, reflect and kind of get the general public to think about war in a different way. And I don't think war is an answer to the problem. This is why the government and the politics exist. We should be able to solve issues such as these in a diplomatic manner and not just dropping bombs and depleted uranium and causing cancer and killing people, innocent people. That's my biggest issue, is innocent people dying.
And NATO has never left, has it? Do you ever go back to the former Yugoslavia? Do you ever hope to go back to stay? And what do you think ought to be done politically now going forward?
Yes, I do actually. I go back every year to Belgrade. I go and visit my friends. I don't have family there. I have some cousins, but it's mainly good friends that I have there. And it's sad to see that, we are not progressing as much as we should. We have a country rich with intellectuals, as I'm sure you're aware, Nikola Tesla comes from Serbia.
Sure.
But when you have if you have so many wars during the centuries, it really you back and you're not able to go forward and develop, and it's difficult for my people in the country to succeed and to earn money, because economically we are not strong. I just truly hope that that there won't be any more wars, and it is very sad to see that that somehow it's always the result and always the choice of politicians or NATO. It's always war, and I don't understand why that is. I really don't. I just think that innocent people don't deserve this. They're trying to live their lives and bring up their families and do something in their lives, achieve something, but they can't do that. They can't, because they keep getting put down by such incidents.
It seems to me, at least in the United States, that a lot of people believe some wars are bad and some wars are good. And because Donald Trump is so horrible on so many things and made some slightly negative comments about NATO, NATO is therefore a good, noble, progressive, liberal force for peace and justice in the world. And because a Democrat, Bill Clinton, was president back in the time of the wars we're talking about, they were good, liberal wars. Do you think that art can break through those sorts of prejudices better than words can?
Can I just make one thing clear? No war is good. No war is good war. War is never, never, never good, and never the answer to any problem. Regarding Bill Clinton obviously allowing for such an incident to happen, well, that's bad on him. That should have never have happened, obviously. I hope that that our current president will do a better thing, and I hope that he will stop any relationship, any collaboration with NATO, and make a stop to this madness. And I hope there won't be any wars with my country or with any country. Regarding the art, yes, I hope that people will kind of, try to understand the art today. I can talk specifically about my art, and it gives me a great pleasure, and I'm so proud that for the first time I'll be showing my war pieces to the public in Washington, and I really hope that I will touch some lives, and I will be able to make the public understand how much war leaves effect. negative effect to people.
We have just a few minutes left. Anna Maria Gower, what other themes other than war do you create art around and remind people where they can go to learn more and find out about your art?
Yeah, thank you, David. So I'm a mixed media artist, and I'm a mixed media artist during the weekend, and during the week, I'm a director of student services at Lincoln University in Oakland, California. We're a small nonprofit university with mostly international students, which is something that I really value. And I always express and I always try to have art classes every week with my students and try to get them to express their feelings through art. As I said, I think art is very, very beautiful. And this is kind of the main thing about my art. I try to express my experiences, my thoughts, my memories, and my traumas through my art. I'm more of an expressionist. I have different theories in my art, and I investigate different topics. But I said a lot of my art is about my memories and my war experience. You can see more of my art on www.annamariagower.com. I have a studio in Berkeley. And once again, thank you so much for this opportunity. Being able to talk on your radio show, and I really, really look forward to going to Washington for No to Nato and Yesterday's Festival in Washington on March
April.
April 3rd and 4th. Sorry.
quite all right. We have been speaking with Anna Maria Gower. You can check out her work at annamariagower.com. And we're talking about the upcoming No to NATO, Yes to Peace Festival in Washington, D.C. Look at notonato.org. NATO is hoping to celebrate its 70th birthday on April 4th, which we believe should be a day dedicated to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who made a great speech against war on that date, 1 year exactly before he was killed on that date. We are going to have protests and demonstrations and actions and artistic activities and speakers and music and food and interactive booths and nonviolent activism, preparation, training, all kinds of activities, a variety of serious speakers and comedians and artists like Anna Maria Gower presenting her art. You can learn more at notonato.org and get involved. Anna Maria Gower, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
And thank you very much, David. Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, every news report contains text, whatever new information is being conveyed, and subtext, a lesson it's underscoring or a pattern that it fits. When it's a foreign policy story, as in coverage of current negotiations on ending the war in Afghanistan, the subtext is that the U.S. may naturally, legitimately unleash all the violent, life-shattering power it sees fit to muster in those countries in which it deems itself interested. And the terms for cessation of that violence should be judged primarily, if not entirely, according to those interests. We'll look at Afghanistan through a different lens with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of, among other titles, Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a Primer with David Wildman, and Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terror. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. The Trump administration's now completely overt effort to overthrow Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro had a very successful public relations effort this week. As FAIR analyst Adam Johnson reported, Western media outlets fell in lockstep, echoing uniformly the claim that the Venezuelan government was blocking a bridge, heartlessly withholding foreign aid from its people. CNN, ABC, NPR, BBC, pick your outlet, all had the same script. Maduro was blocking aid from the U.S. out of a refusal to relinquish power, preferring to starve his own people rather than feed them. And there was photographic proof, a picture of trucks blocking a bridge. Some of the information that for media now is clearly beside the point, and that in the future they will earnestly assert that no one knew. For one, the bridge in question between Venezuela and Colombia has never actually been open to traffic. It's been blocked by both countries for some time. Other bridges, however, are open. More germane, people actually involved in bringing aid, like the International Red Cross and the United Nations, had previously explicitly warned the U.S. not to engage in these types of PR stunts, using aid as a kind of pawn. Johnson cites Washington Post contributor Vincent Bevins, who noted that the Red Cross only recently doubled its budget to deliver relief in Venezuela, offering evidence that the Maduro government is more than willing to work with international aid when it's offered in good faith, just not when it's a thinly veiled mechanism to contrive PR victories for those seeking to overthrow the government. Joe Emmersberger also points out on FAIR.org the amount of aid with which elite U.S. media are currently righteously consumed amounts to a rounding error compared with the impact of the billions of dollars lost to economic sanctions begun under Barack Obama and intensified under Trump. Last but not least, there's the difficult reality that the Venezuelan government has an entirely rational reason to suspect that the U.S. would use humanitarian aid as a cover to smuggle in weapons to foment armed conflict, given that the person running quarterback for Trump on the current Venezuela operation, Elliot Abrams, did literally exactly that, authorizing by his own proud admission, and as reported in U.S. media at the time, the shipment of weapons on a humanitarian aid flight to Nicaraguan rebels in the mid-1980s. It is, as Johnson writes, the same actors, the same tricks, the same patently disingenuous concern for the starving poor. And the U.S. media are stripping it all of this essential context, presenting these radical regime change operators as bleeding heart humanitarians. The fact-checking brigade that emerged to confront the Trump administration is suddenly non-existent as that administration rolls out a transparent, cynical strategy to delegitimize a Latin American government that it's trying to overthrow. And in better news, a federal appeals court has overturned FCC Chair Ajit Pai's attempt to gut the subsidy that makes it possible for low-income communities to access broadband. For reasons known only to themselves, the FCC's Republican majority voted last fall to make it much harder for people, including tribal residents, to obtain a subsidy provided by a program appropriately called Lifeline. Lifeline helps people who qualify with a $9.25 monthly subsidy to buy phone and internet service. For those living on tribal lands, the subsidy is $25 in recognition of additional hurdles to access they face. Nearly 11 million people subscribe, which still represents just 28% of eligible households. As John Brodkin at Ars Technica reminds, the Lifeline program started as a landline phone subsidy under Ronald Reagan, then became a wireless subsidy program under George W. Bush, and then a phone and internet program under Barack Obama. In other words, it's not a controversial thing, just seen as a relatively cheap way to bridge an increasingly critical and unconscionable divide. That is, until we get to Trump's FCC and former Verizon lawyer Pai. As part of their evident public interest, what's that, philosophy, Pai and pals pushed through a change of policy to limit access to Lifeline last fall. They just didn't bother to make much of a case. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit stayed the FCC decision pending appeal, and as Brodkin reports, the same court followed that up early this month with a ruling reversing the FCC decision and remanding the matter back to the commission for a new rulemaking proceeding. Among other should-be embarrassing things, the judges wrote that the commission's decisions were arbitrary and capricious, without a reasoned explanation supported by record evidence. And the agency ignored that its decision is a fundamental change that adversely affects the access and affordability of service for residents of tribal lands. Similarly, in adopting the tribal rural limitation, the commission's decision evinces no consideration of the impact on services access and affordability. It's almost as if they don't have the public interest at heart. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Some jokes write themselves. When we learned negotiations on Afghanistan suggested the possibility of an end to the grueling 17-year war, the longest in U.S. history, the New York Times ran a piece headlined, "Fearing What Could Follow a Quick Exit." The U.S. invasion and occupation have devastated the country and killed more than 100,000 people, but consider, cautions the Washington Post, quote, "An end to the Afghan war is desirable, but not at the expense of everything the United States has helped to build there since 2001. Close quote. What and who is missing from such conversations around the current talks about Afghanistan and from the talks themselves? Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is author of numerous books, including Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a Primer, co-authored with David Wildman. She joins us now in studio. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Janine.
Well, things are in flux. Things are changing, absolutely. We're recording on February 13th. What do we know about the nature of these ongoing negotiations?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's always important for there to be negotiations. Wars end with negotiated settlements before, during, or after massive killing. So having those talks after such a long time is a good thing. It's a good thing that the U.S. has finally acknowledged that the Taliban exists. They, in fact, control somewhere, depending on who you believe, somewhere between 50% and 70% of the country's territory. So they're obviously a force that has to be reckoned with and has to be part of the negotiations. That's all good. If we look at who's not at the table, then it's a little more problematic. The Afghan government is not at the table. That's not the worst thing in the world. The Afghan government is as corrupt as governments come. The Taliban has refused to talk to the Afghan government on the theory that they are nothing but puppets of the United States, which is mostly true, probably not entirely true, but they certainly are not an independent actor. More importantly, however, who's not at the table includes women, crucially, particularly because the U.S. claim is that the war in Afghanistan is grounded in the need to, quote, protect women. We hear this in the mainstream press all the time. We also are not hearing from Afghan trade unions, Afghan farmers, Afghan tribal or religious leaders. We're not hearing from youth leaders. We're basically not hearing from any of the Afghan people. So that's a serious problem. In some ways, a greater problem is who is at the table. So talks between the U.S. and the Taliban, not a bad thing. But on the U.S. side, who's leading those talks? Well, it's a guy named Zalmay Khalilzad, who's a longtime cohort of the Bush family, a longtime oil guy. He worked for UNICAL in the 1970s and 80s. He was one of these analysts sort of assessing the threats they would face in different parts of the world. And one of the things that he's most known for, it was written up in the Washington Post back in the mid-90s about an incident that had happened in 1995, I think it was, when Zalmay Khalilzad went to Afghanistan and brought back with him, this is during the Afghan Civil War, when the Taliban is fighting against a coalition of warlords known as the Northern Alliance. The Northern Alliance, of course, backed by India at the time, against the Taliban, which was backed by Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. In that period, he came back to the U.S., back to Houston, with a delegation of the Taliban to negotiate pipeline deals. And it was one of those things where it was described with a certain tongue-in-cheek approach in the Post. They described this lavish dinner at some fancy hotel in Houston. And nobody mentioned anything about how the Taliban, even then, was known for its most extreme forms of repression against women, these really medieval kinds of punishments in their courts that involved amputation for theft, things like that. The destruction of parts of Afghans' cultural heritage. None of that was mentioned. It was all just sort of, we think these guys are going to win the war, so we should be dealing with them now. That's the same guy. That was under George Bush the First. Under George Bush the Second, Khalilzad became the ambassador first to Afghanistan and then to Iraq. He was later the ambassador to the United Nations. So he's been around. He's a neocon, an oil guy, a Bush guy, and now all of a sudden he's Trump's guy. So Trump has now appointed him as the special envoy to Afghanistan. Now, in some ways, that's kind of great. He speaks several of the local languages. He is a brilliant, urbane, and charming diplomat. I remember when he came to the United Nations, nobody in the mainstream press talked about this. But one of the things that happened was that he was replacing John Bolton, who Bush, too, had tried and failed to get approved by the Senate as the U.S. ambassador to the UN. Everybody hated Bolton. Nobody wanted to help the U.S. because Bolton was such a bully. When he was finally replaced with this charming guy who everybody adored, he was an Afghan, a person of color at the U.N. representing the U.S., wow, it was a whole different story. People could not wait to get him on their side, to have tea with him. He would look into your eyes when he spoke. Such a good diplomat, right? Representing these terrible positions. So I remember that very well. And now he's the one representing the U.S. in talks with his former clients, the Taliban. So what are we supposed to make of that?
And who's going to help us make sense of that? Well, it's going to be, for example, the New York Times, who are saying, well, the primary concern is if the United States troops leave Afghanistan, we'd be handing over the country to the same ruthless militants that the United States went to war to dislodge. And they're talking about the Taliban, and that's their explanation for the purpose of the war, and it's in that context that they're going to talk about the agreement.
It is sort of extraordinary. There's a sense in the mainstream press. You see it in the Times, you see it in the Post, you hear it on NPR, you see it on all the network news, you hear it on CNN, you hear it pretty much everywhere, that we maybe should get out relatively soon, but not too fast. And I'm thinking, okay, almost 18 years. How long do we have to occupy the country before we can say it's not too fast? I mean, what makes it fast when we've been there for 18 years? And we should note, you know, you remember, Janine, how much of the press back in 2001 when the U.S. first invaded Afghanistan and right up until today, a huge amount of the press coverage has focused on the question of women.
Right.
Now, with some legitimacy, there is no question that the Taliban is one of the most ruthless, misogynistic political forces out there. And the prospect of them holding 50%, let alone even more, is a terrible one for the women of Afghanistan. But what we never hear is, well, how different is it? How much better is it for women under areas not controlled by the Taliban, controlled by what I believe to be an incredibly misogynistic gang of ruthless warlords that's called the Afghan government, backed by the United States? It is true that in Kabul, there have been some significant gains for urban women. Schools have been built. There are women in the parliament. There are women in some of the professions. But overwhelmingly, 80% of Afghans do not live in the city. They live in tiny rural villages, very far removed from anything that happens in Kabul. And we don't hear about that in the Times or the Post or NPR or anywhere else. What we hear about is what's going to happen to women in Kabul. And that could be bad. It could get worse when the U.S. pulls out. But I would just note two things about that. Number one, a statistic. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, the Taliban had been in control for about 5 years. The condition for women was horrifying. According to the UN, to all the various figures from UNICEF and others, Afghanistan was one of – it was either the first or second worst place in the world for children to be born and survive. Today, after 18 years of U.S. occupation supposedly aimed at improving the lives of women, where is Afghanistan on the ratings? Number one in infant mortality. The same place. It has not improved. So that's number one. Number two, there was an extraordinary young woman who was the youngest person elected to the Afghan parliament back in 2004, I guess it was, or five, a woman named Malalai Joya. And she said something very interesting about this. Again, something you never heard about. She said when I was having a conversation with her, she was in the U.S. for a while, and I asked her about this question of would it be worse for women and for civil society in Afghanistan if and when the U.S. pulls out. And she said, you know, we in civil society and we women in Afghanistan, we have three big problems, three enemies of our rights. One is the Taliban. They are certainly an enemy of our rights. Two is the Afghan government, certainly an enemy of our rights. And third is the U.S. occupying forces who are continuing the war and are certainly responsible for the denial of rights of all of us. So she said, if you in the U.S. can arrange the withdrawal of one of those, get the U.S. troops out, we'll only have two. I thought that was a very prescient understanding of the situation.
18 years doesn't even really, you know, contain the whole breadth of it, because before that, of course, there were years and years of U.S.-backed anti-Soviet war in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Some of us remember Dan Rather in a cave, you know, reporting the. And so I was struck by the New York Times analysis that U.S. withdrawal, quote, could consign Afghanistan to a protracted bloody civil war, close quote.
What have we been waging for the last 17 and a half years, if not the second or third iteration of a protracted bloody civil war?
Well, let me ask you on Afghanistan, if we think not in an isolationist way, but if we center the priorities of the Afghan people, what criteria would we be using to judge any agreement?
Well, I think first the question of who's at the table, which goes to whose interests are being at least acknowledged, if not recognized. Two, is there any discussion anywhere? There has not been yet. Of the need for reparations, compensation for the extraordinary devastation that our years of war have brought to the people of Afghanistan. Certainly, plenty of damage has been done by the Taliban. Plenty has been done by other warlords. Plenty has been done by the Afghan government. But what the U.S. is directly responsible for because of the continuing drone war, airstrikes, so much death and destruction, The notion that we could be convening peace talks and not even acknowledge that, not even to begin the conversation about how do we begin to help rebuild, that's, to me, one of the indicators that I don't think we're going to be hearing too much about in the mainstream press.
And that, given that our U.S. mainstream press are writing largely for Americans, ought to really be leading the conversation. Well, while we have you here, Phyllis Bennis, you wrote the book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, now in its seventh updated edition, and helped found the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. I have to ask you what you are making of the reaction to the comments made by Representative Ilhan Omar about the influence of AIPAC on U.S. policy.
This was an extraordinary moment. What Ilhan said was that money is the basis for the power of pro-Israel sentiment and pro-Israel resolutions and decisions in the Congress. That's hardly news. That's not something that's so surprising to anybody. When she was asked derisively, she took it as a serious question on the question, who do you think is responsible? Her answer was AIPAC. Not exactly news. Again, you know, if we're talking about breaking news, AIPAC takes money to influence Congress. Really? Why is this surprising? You know, first of all, this is what lobbies do. AIPAC is hardly the only lobby that does it. The NRA does it very powerfully. The arms manufacturers, they pour billions of dollars over the years into campaigns for various sorts. AIPAC does it very, very well. They're very skilled. AIPAC, of course, is not a political action committee. They don't make donations. What they do is act as bundlers of other small foundations and other agencies that do directly aid Congress and Senate campaigns.
Amplifiers.
Amplifiers. That's a good word for it. That's what the press likes to use. That's true. They are definitely amplifiers. They also have been known to use money to threaten members of Congress. Not to say if you toe the line on Israel, if you vote for all of our agenda items, which means uncritical support in the United Nations for any Israeli violations of international law, continuing or escalating U.S. military aid to Israel to the point that it's now $38 billion that has been pledged over a 10-year period, $3.8 billion a year, direct of our tax money right to the Israeli military. If you toe the line on all of that, we'll give you money. That's not exactly how it works. More often, it's if you don't toe the line, we will find and we will fund an opponent you may have never even heard of yet, and they will beat you in the next primary. That's how they operate. So the notion that AIPAC uses money is hardly news. Now, the claim is made that, oh my God, she said it in a way that is these anti-Semitic tropes. Well, I've got to say, growing up Jewish and hearing a lot about anti-Semitism, I never heard that particular trope that had anything to do with with Puff Daddy's rap song about
the Benjamin.
The Benjamins. You know, when I first saw it, I was thinking Benjamin, because that's a kind of common Jewish name. Is that what it's about? And then I realized, oh my God, no, this is referencing that. So this was not actually about the words she used. Somebody said to me on a debate yesterday or a discussion yesterday, a good discussion, somebody said, well, but wouldn't it have been better if we could go back in time and just ask Congresswoman Omar to just say it a different way and we wouldn't all have to be dealing with this? And my answer was, it doesn't matter. This was not a response to those particular words. This was a response to two things. Number one, it was somebody calling out AIPAC in the context of calling out U.S. congressional refusal to recognize Palestinian rights. That was number one. Number two, even more importantly, was that the person calling out AIPAC is a young, black, African, Muslim refugee. And in the eyes of people like Kevin McCarthy, people like that are just not supposed to be in Congress. That's what this was about. So you have somebody like McCarthy, who was himself known for these really anti-Semitic tweets that identified individual Jews, wealthy billionaire Jews, as trying to buy elections. Really? That's your claim here? You know, he could say that and not be held accountable at all.
But it does have to do just finally with who media decide is legitimately in the conversation, whose words need sifting, who we can look to as sources of presumed bias, and who, on the other hand, gets to be presented just as a legitimate source. And so it does connect us to the conversation about Afghanistan, and it does connect us to the conversation about Venezuela and Syria. It has a lot to do with who media think are legitimately participants in the conversation.
I think that's absolutely right. But the good news is that the discourse, particularly on the question of Palestine, is changing massively. So the fact is that when Ilhan Omar said AIPAC is responsible, it wasn't really news. If she hadn't gotten the pushback and the attacks that she did, it would have passed right by, because this is now understood. The discourse in the Jewish community is different. The discourse in the media is different. The media has not yet caught up with the public discourse, and the policy, of course, has not close to catching up to the media. But all of them are in flux. All of them are changing. And it's because of our movements. It's because of the news outlets of our movement, and it's because of our movements overall, organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, that I'm very honored to be on the steering committee of. It's like the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. It's like Palestine Legal. It's like Black for Palestine. All of these organizations that have been working for years to change the discourse, we're now seeing that work bearing fruit. And that's hugely important.
I'm going to end on that note. We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. They're online at ips-dc.org. And you can find her recent article, Is the Longest U.S. War Finally Ending?, on truthout.org. Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Great to be with you here in your office.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShot.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Later in this program, we are going to talk with Mike Davis, author of Ecology of Fear and Planet of Slums. In 1990, Davis explained why California would burn. Now we'll get his reaction to being right. But first...
Enjoy yourself. It's later than you think. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy yourself. It's later than you think.
You may believe climate disruption is arriving sooner than we were told. You are right. Three powerhouse scientists have published a warning. Global warming will happen faster than we think. They explain three emerging threats that combine to bring climate danger out of that year 2100 and right into the next decade. Our guide to the comment, published by the prestigious journal Nature, is co-author David G. Victor. At the University of California, San Diego, Dr. Victor is a professor of international relations and director of the Laboratory on International Law and Regulation. He is a connected guy, often producing reports for the Brookings Institution while publishing articles in magazines like The New Yorker. David Victor is the author of the book Global Warming Gridlock, published by Cambridge University Press. David Victor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's go straight to this important new article in Nature. You were teamed up with co-author Ram Ramanathan from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He's one of the gods of science to me. And the lead author is the brilliant young scientist from Texas A&M, Dr. Yang Yang Zhu. And David, what brought you three together, and is there an urgency behind your message?
Well, what brought us together was Yang Yang's PhD. He was a student of ours at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, where I'm also an adjunct professor. And Ram Ramanathan and I, over the years, have written a lot of things together, do a lot of projects together, advise students together. And Yang Yang was one of our students and one of our sharpest students. And he's a terrific climate modeler. And what brought us together on this particular story was the observation that the new IPCC report, this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body that assesses climate science, that new report had warned of the risks of rapid warming, and it suggested that we might get to 1.5 degrees of warming by 2040 or beyond. And we looked at that and thought that's actually maybe even not pessimistic or worrisome enough, that when you look at the underlying data, as we've done now in this new Nature comment, that the rate of warming is even faster than the IPCC had warned. And that's what got us together working on this and led us to write this article.
And in November, the world's top medical journal, Lancet, published their 2018 report on health and climate change. And that seems to reinforce the idea that we're already hotter. People are experiencing it by the hundreds of millions.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, Ram Ramanathan and I and several people involved with the Pontifical Academy of Sciences had an article in Foreign Affairs, the foreign policy journal, foreignaffairs.com, earlier last year, that laid out all the evidence that warming is now happening, and including having big impacts on human health. And we're interested in this in part because we're worried about the impacts, and in part because we're concerned about the politics. And we're thinking as the effects of climate change become more tangible, that more people are going to want to do something about it, because it's, you know, frankly, serious political action on climate change is, you know, decades overdue.
So let's focus on those three trends that will, quote, combine over the next 20 years to make climate change faster and more furious than anticipated, end quote. And point one is rising emissions. That is kind of a surprise to us all. Talk to us about that, David.
Yeah, it's interesting. A decade or two ago, the IPCC, the same body that assesses the climate science, put together a set of scenarios for future emissions. And they did, as is typical in this business, they did scenarios where there's no real change in policy, you get very high emissions, scenarios where there are various kinds of changes in policy, including scenarios that would bend emissions down, eventually have 50-80% cuts in global emissions consistent with stopping warming at 2 degrees. And so there's this kind of range of scenarios because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. What's interesting to me as an analyst of the energy system is that emissions today are basically on track for the highest emission scenarios that were published a decade or two ago, which means that despite all the talking about climate change, there's not a lot of doing. So emissions keep going up. There's a study out just in the last couple of days that U.S. emissions were up, I think, about 2.8% last year, even though they've been declining for more than a decade prior to that. Global emissions are up higher than people expected. There was a study that came out actually the same issue of Nature as our article. And so when you take a step back from this, I think it's very important that we have these diplomatic conferences and all this policy activity around climate change. But when you look at the data and the impact on emissions, you're not seeing it.
You know, about 10 years ago, I interviewed the famous climate blogger Joe Rome, and the accepted view then was that climate change would be slow and warming only 0.1 degree per decade. What is the new understanding of how fast Earth will heat up?
Well, the new understanding, which, again, we don't know exactly, but the new understanding is kind of double that rate in that ballpark. And the argument we made in our article was that it's accelerating. So it's not just that it's rising linearly at a rate faster than 0.1 degree, but that the rate itself is growing. And that's what's really concerning here, is you've got an exponential process with lots of uncertainty, risks that the climate system could really get out of control, and that the system is being torqued with these building emissions in the atmosphere, and that's causing exponential changes, not linear changes.
The second trend that you pinpoint in the comment is the partial success by government regulations to reduce air pollution. Surely less smog is good news for our lungs, but how is it also bad news?
Well, most of what you do to address other environmental problems also helps reduce climate change. But in a few areas, they work in opposite directions. And this is one of the areas. There are especially coal-fired power plants, but a variety of other sources, but especially coal-fired power plants emit a lot of pollutants. They emit carbon dioxide, which is what causes climate change. They emit nitrogen oxides, which cause acid rain and local air pollution effects. They emit sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain, and a variety of other pollutants. Sulfur dioxide is the one that we're talking a lot about in our article. And what happens to sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere is it turns into sulfate particles, which make clouds brighter. And so they actually ironically cool the planet a little bit. And the Chinese know that they've got a huge local air pollution and regional air pollution problem. So they've been investing very heavily in controlling emissions from their coal-fired power plants. They've shut down old inefficient plants, built new kinds of coal-fired power plants with all the latest pollution control equipment, and it's on and operating. And so they've very quickly lowered their emissions of these other pollutants. And that's been really good for Chinese health, and they need to do more. But it's ironically lessened this brightening effect, the mask, if you like, that's existed on climate warming. And that mask has had a large offsetting effect on climate warming. And so as that mask is removed more rapidly than this, almost all the scenarios had predicted, that's contributing to the accelerated warming.
How do scientists know there has been a reduction in air pollution? How do we measure such things?
Well, there's a variety of ways of measuring it. Some pollutants you can measure from satellites. There's a lot of, frankly, on-the-ground work by experts in power plants and other industrial technologies where they go off and look and see what kinds of technologies are installed and try and develop a story as to what is actually going on the ground. Some of these pollutants you can measure downwind, and so you have to put together lots of different data sources to get to this. You know, there's still a lot of uncertainty about Chinese energy statistics. There's still more uncertainty about Chinese CO2 emissions than you would like to have. And so nobody really knows exactly what's going on the ground, I guess, is that even the Chinese government doesn't fully know. But the data picture has improved a lot, and it's all consistent with this story that the Chinese are aggressively trying to clean up their act. I mean, so much so that the air pollution, the kind of legendary air pollution problems in Beijing, although they still exist, they're now being eclipsed by legendary air pollution problems in other countries, and notably in India. I think India is going to be the next big story in this area where there's going to be a need for cleanup and a need for more efficient and less polluting coal plants and alternatives to coal like solar. And that story, though, is still unfolding.
So do we know how much warming is hidden by global dimming or this layer of aerosols in the atmosphere?
Not exactly, but it's on the order of half a degree. And we have in the paper, we have some pointers to some other estimates, but it's something in that range.
So when the IPCC proposes to stay below 2 degrees C warming, and they use dubious carbon capture technology for those scenarios, do they include up to 2/3 of a degree more heating, which will emerge when air pollution is cleaned up?
Well, so there's a separate set of articles that some of which I've been involved with, that have raised questions about whether we're in fact setting our goals for climate policy in the right way. And this is one of the key points of contention, that right now we talk about goals in terms of globally average temperature. In fact, globally average air temperature near the surface of the Earth. But the reality is that temperature is affected by lots of factors. Some of them are naturally variable in nature, including cycles in the oceans in the Pacific and the Atlantic, which might actually be one of the additional factors that's causing warming. So there's natural variability. And then most of the heat actually does not build up in the atmosphere. It builds up in the oceans. And so a number of us have raised questions about whether we should be looking at other ways of setting global goals that would be more directly related to how humans are affecting the climate and to the policies that humans are adopting to try and control their emissions. And that would make it easier to measure actual progress. Because right now, it's actually very hard to take the pulse of whether we're doing well or poorly with climate policy, because our major indicator is a globally average indicator that's responsive to so many different factors.
You've already raised the third major driver covered in your comment, that faster warming could come because of entering a natural warm phase that could last for a couple of decades. That's probably the hardest for the public to understand. Could you take a couple of minutes to explain why a natural warming may pile on to our greenhouse pollution?
Yeah, there are a lot of different things going on. Let me just talk about one as an illustration. One of the things that people are concerned about is that the circulation of the oceans might change with, in fact, probably will change with climate warming. And in the past, it has changed. And so when the circulation speeds up or slows down, that alters how much heat it can be taken out of the surface oceans and put into the deep oceans. And so those are the kinds of natural cycles that could be amplified or slowed down or adjusted as a result of climate warming. And then that, in turn, would have an effect on the globally averaged surface temperature, and therefore would have an effect on whether we're meeting our goals.
David Victor, you have a strange habit of visiting power plants, perhaps even on family vacations. What are you finding lately that you did not see 10 years ago?
Well, I think there are two things that are very interesting. One is that the technology in the power industry is really global, and that began 25, 30 years ago, but it's really accelerated. Today, if you go visit the best power plants in the world, increasingly you're seeing the best technology everywhere. And a lot of that has been an effect in China, where advanced technology has been tested in China, and then Chinese companies have merged around that technology. Now the Chinese are spreading that technology around through initiatives like the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a big outward investment program led by the Chinese government. And so the technology has become global, which means that as we develop better ideas, they come into service much more quickly. And overall, the effect of that has been to probably help slow the growth in emissions, because a lot of these technologies are more efficient. So that's one trend that I think is really, really interesting. The other trend that's interesting is the renewables revolution is happening more quickly than people expected. And I'm skeptical that we can go to all renewables quickly, and very involved with some technical papers to look at the plausibility of that. But there's no question that on the ground, there's a lot more solar and a lot more wind, and that has helped shift away from high carbon fuels to low carbon fuels. I am concerned that people think that we're going to solve the carbon problem entirely with solar and wind, when in reality, we're going to need all technologies. We're going to need advanced nuclear power. There's a lot of new nuclear power being built in China, to some degree in Korea, now even in the Persian Gulf. And so that's, I think, actually a very encouraging trend, where that can be done safely and properly in a cost-effective way. And there might also be a role for carbon capture and storage, where some fossil fuels continue to get used, but the pollution gets captured and put underground before it goes up in the atmosphere. And there's, in particular, an advanced natural gas carbon capture and storage plant being tested right now outside Houston, Texas, that I think is if it works, is going to be very, very important, because there's so much natural gas in the world.
And your paper seems to say that because we're going to have this faster warming, we need a forefront approach. And it seems to begin with a criticism of climate science that perhaps it has been too long-sighted. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so we don't want to take climate scientists completely to task. This is a hard business. There's lots of complexity and uncertainty. But there has been, for almost since the beginning of serious analysis of global warming, there's been an attention on long-term warming, 100-year, sometimes 1,000-year warming, because the models work better in that way, and we can understand the equilibrium and the kind of geophysical adjustments in the climate system as a result of that. So that kind of work is very important. But one of the things we're saying in the article is that because warming is happening now faster, we need to be developing and deploying better tools for understanding shorter-term patterns in warming, and then what can be done to slow down those short-term rates of warming to generate immediate benefits from actions to control pollution. This is one of the areas where Ram Ramanathan in particular has been most well-known, which is the potential for controlling emissions of soot, which is a huge killer in terms of air pollution and also a big contributor to climate warming. And so if you can control soot emissions, that results in very quick impact on the climate. And politically, I think that's very interesting because it means that the politics of controlling soot are easier than the politics of controlling, for example, carbon dioxide, because soot kills people and has their immediate local benefits to less soot, and there are tangible benefits in terms of less climate warming. Whereas one of the reasons why it's been politically hard to make a lot of progress on the climate problem is that the main pollutant is carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide is invisible, odorless. It essentially causes no other problems other than climate warming and acidification of the oceans. And so it builds up over very long periods of time. And in order to control that pollutant, you have to spend a lot of money today to reduce emissions for benefits that are really only going to accumulate far in the future and mostly in other countries. And so politically, the structure of the carbon dioxide as a pollutant is very inconvenient for making big actions in this area, whereas the politics around controlling soot and controlling a few other pollutants that are shorter lived, those politics are a little more tractable.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to the world broadcast of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor David G. Victor. We're talking about a new warning: global warming will happen faster than we think. David, you and your co-authors are calling for a new IPCC report. What do we need?
Yeah, we need a report to understand the transition, what rapid warming really means, and how plausibly we can control emissions. My chief criticism, the IPCC just issued a special report last fall on the potential impacts of 1.5 degrees of warming. So a lot of people have been talking for years about 2 degrees of warming. There's a growing evidence that even 2 degrees of warming may cause big impacts. And so the IPCC was asked to look at 1.5 degrees. And so they did that. They came out with this report last fall. And most of that report's great because it provides new science and a new assessment of science around the consequences of 1.5 degrees. But the part of the report that's most kind of incredible is the part of the report that deals with how you could control emissions very quickly to get to 1.5 degrees. And it's incredible because it assumes a whole bunch of technologies come into place very quickly, and then we can rapidly reduce emissions. And that's just not going to happen in the real world. So we need a better assessment of science that's around the real political feasibility of actions.
From the Arctic to India, I see reports that large parts of the world have already warmed past 1.5 degrees C for most of the year at least. And frankly, I feel the discussion of 1.5 as a target is almost a cruel joke. We will pass that quickly. Why bother with an impossible target?
That's my view as well. We're going to go through 1.5 degrees. So it's been kind of a political rallying point, but I don't see how we're feasibly going to stop warming at 1.5 degrees. And I think that's the new reality of climate change, that if you believe the science that warming is happening faster than people originally expected, and you look in a sober way at the last 30 years, we've been talking a lot but not doing very much. We've got to get ready for a world that's going to be worse than inconveniently, a lot warmer, impacts worse than we expected. That means that climate adaptation is going to be a bigger deal. It means we're going to see more discussions around the concept of geoengineering, which is the idea that you engineer the climate directly to kind of offset in a crude way potential impacts of climate change. And, you know, none of this is attractive. All of it is seriously fraught with problems, but that's the world that we're in right now.
Back in 2008, you published for the Oxford Press a study on how to regulate geoengineering, and it was still a pretty young subject at the time. And when it comes to the control of geoengineering and the protection of everybody's interests, what is the best we can hope for?
I think we don't really know, actually, right now. But the 2008 article came out of a scientific conference around geoengineering where literally the entire scientific community working on the topic could fit in one seminar room. And they were there, most of them. Nowadays, a lot more people working on this, and there's a diffusion of the technologies, not a lot of real-world testing. The number one scenario that I'm concerned about is that some rogue nation will say this climate change is happening quickly and it's harming our people. We need to show our people that we're doing something about it, and they're going to go off and do some half-baked geoengineering scheme, a kind of Dr. Strangelove kind of thing, running off and doing this. And then the rest of the world's going to be stuck with the consequences of that, because geoengineering systems are hard to localize in one particular place on the planet. And so that's the scenario that really concerns me the most.
Me too. And if the world is warming much faster than we expected, and we get examples of it like the California fires, do you think humans will eventually be forced to shade out some of the sun while we figure out what else to do?
I don't know if we'll be forced. I think that the incentives for some people to do this will go up and possibly go up a lot. This is always going to be enormously controversial. I mean, this is almost playing God with the planet. It's literally taking the thermostat directly in our control and trying to manipulate it. We're doing that right now with the greenhouse gases that are building up in the atmosphere, but that's not a purposeful activity in the sense that people are trying to cause this harm, whereas geoengineering would be purposeful efforts to try and directly manipulate with very quick response the temperature and other attributes of the climate. So I think that's always going to be controversial in some countries. But I think what's going to happen is the incentives for other countries to go off and do this or test this, or you know, maybe for some rich dude with a convenient island nation at his disposal or her disposal to just go off and start doing some of these things, those incentives are going to go up. And I've written a little bit about this, you know, 10 years or so ago, and thought some of this was kind of science fiction, but interesting. I'd say that it's moving out of the fiction category into some kind of plausible reality.
Yes, Harvard's doing an experiment, but it's only a scientific experiment to see how these materials could be spread out in the atmosphere. And I think that's going to come up this year. We'll see what happens. Now, David Victor, among other things, you are a regulations expert. You can advise governments, but we see governments are failing on climate action, not just in America, but in Brazil now, Poland, Russia, and beyond. Can we maintain a political environment where regulatory approaches could really work?
Well, this is a hard problem. This is plausibly the hardest problem, hardest sustained problem the global community has worried about. And, you know, the conspicuous failures of government, like in the United States, or you mentioned in the case of Brazil under the new government, those failures are conspicuous. But even the countries that have really been leaders in this area are having a hard time. Germany and France, for example. Britain is distracted because of Brexit. Japan has long been a leader in this area, but the Japanese economy is already pretty efficient, and so their capacity to make big reductions in emissions is limited. There's a kind of growing disconnect between what people are saying they're going to do in terms of emissions control and what they're actually going to do. I'm pessimistic about the short term. I think the politics of this is a really, really hard. I'm optimistic over the longer term, in part because the evidence of damage will grow, and in part because of technology, that as the technologies for reducing emissions become better, that makes the politics easier because it makes this a less costly problem. It also creates interest groups that want to deploy technologies, whether it's advanced nuclear reactors or wind and solar. And so those interest groups get organized and they push for more policy. And that's the way we've actually solved most of our environmental problems. It's just that the climate problem has proved to be a much, much harder one to address. And so the solution set has been a much slower coming into place.
Can you give us any examples of what governments could do for rapid adaptation to faster climate change?
One of the things I think is interesting about adaptation to climate change is that politically, it's almost the opposite of controlling emissions. So in controlling emissions, you really need central governments to adopt policies across the entire economy. You spend a ton of money. That affects organized interest groups today, and the benefits are far in the future. Adapting to climate impacts are the exact opposite. Most adaptation is local. It affects, you know, communities that are affected by potential inundation from rising sea levels, extreme storms, wildfires, all those kinds of things. It's mainly a local and to some degree regional planning activity. And whether or not you believe in climate science, if the ocean is rising, you got to do something about it. And so the politics of adaptation are actually going to be easier, I think, than the politics of controlling emissions in the first place. So I think that's the key point here, is we're starting to see in the United States, for example, even places that have voters who are most skeptical about climate science, like in Florida, and voted people who voted for Trump and are thrilled that Trump is leaving the Paris Agreement, those are exactly the communities that are on the front lines of climate impacts and are being forced to develop adaptation measures. But there's no silver bullet in adaptation. It's lots of stuff. It's seawalls. It's nourishing sand on beaches. It's moving houses that are in vulnerable areas. It's bigger fire breaks. It's just it's a whole dog's breakfast of activities that you need to do, and they're all bespoke to local conditions.
David, Victor, what is your take on the COP24 climate conference in Katowice, Poland in December 2018?
Yeah. I mean, they went there. They had a meeting. They made, it appears, a little bit of progress on what's called the rule book, which are the rules for reporting data and a variety of other things. There was no big deadline there. I would say that the expectations appropriately were very low, and they easily made them because the expectations were low. Now, I think the real problem is it's easy to think that diplomacy can get a lot done in this area, but this is really not a diplomatic problem. It's a leadership problem. It's a problem that requires some countries to go out and do things and show the world, here's how you do it, and then show the world, here's what I promised I would do, here's what I did, here's what I couldn't do. And that's the whole logic of the Paris process, is it gets countries to make their own pledges as to what they're going to do and then follow up on those pledges. And that's a little bit of that is about the rule book and the diplomacy, you know, things like COP24. But most of it is, frankly, about political energy and political focus. And I'm very concerned that the political focus has come off climate change, you know, despite all the evidence, because the world is focused on a lot of other things. You know, trade wars, Brexit, the strange behavior of the United States president, kind of list goes on.
And your article talks about global warming as a speeding freight train, and it feels to me like most people in the developed world are most comfortable staying paralyzed on the tracks. You talk about this in your book, Global Warming Gridlock. Can we break out?
Well, I mean, the difference between this and an actual freight train is in an actual freight train, if you're on the tracks and you see the train coming, you get off the tracks. In our case, we're on the planet, and nobody's leaving the planet. Almost nobody's leaving the planet. So we're there. We got to deal with it. That's the real new politics of climate change, is that the attention to climate impacts, to managing those impacts, to adaptation, potentially to geoengineering, that part of the debate, which used to be peripheral and even taboo, not so long ago, because people didn't want to take political attention away from controlling emissions. That part of the debate, what we're going to see in the coming years, already happening, that part of the debate is going to surge because people are going to be forced to deal with those realities. And some parts of the world, you know, sadly, the countries that are least responsible for causing climate problems, the least developed countries, are the ones that will be most vulnerable to many of the climate impacts, including small island nations, because one way to become more, you know, immune to climate impacts is to become richer and have stronger institutions and better capacity to build public infrastructures. That's all the stuff that these societies have the hardest time doing.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I would like to say one thing, which is there's been a lot of attention to the U.S. government leaving the scene because of the Trump administration, and that's unfortunate. And my guess is that will change, but it'll require new elections. But at the same time, other parts of the U.S. are still there. And I think that's increasingly the story, is to make real progress on the climate change problem requires leadership and jurisdictions that demonstrate here's how to control emissions, here's what it really costs. And that leadership is mostly coming from smaller jurisdictions and not big countries. And in the United States, it's coming from the coastal zones, in particular California, where I live. You're seeing leadership from individual firms. You're seeing leadership from parts of Canada. You're seeing leadership from lots of places. And so we need to help the leaders do a better job leading, and in particular, help the leaders develop strategies that can be easily replicated in other parts of the world, because it's, you know, it just doesn't help for a leader that doesn't emit very much to come up with a fancy way of controlling emissions. They've got to have something that scales ultimately to the globe.
We have been talking with Dr. David G. Victor, Professor of International Relations and Director of the Laboratory on International Law and Regulation at UC San Diego. David is co-author of the paper, Global Warming Will Happen Faster Than We Think. You can find links to follow up on all of this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David Victor, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure to join you. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When California burned in 2018, I thought of Mike Davis. In the early 1990s, Davis wrote books explaining why all this was inevitable. Davis grew up in Southern California, where he became a powerful leftist voice and a celebrated author. From The Ecology of Fear to Planet of Slums, everyone has felt ripples from his work. Mike Davis is a distinguished professor in creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, and an editor of the New Left Review. Mike Davis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be on.
In your 1992 book, The Ecology of Fear, you wrote a lot about human incursion into fire areas and the inevitable blowback of wildfires into suburbs and monster homes in Malibu. How does that feel after the terrible fires hit both Southern and Northern California in late 2018?
I often write about things that personally terrify me, and I've seen Los Angeles burn and San Diego, where I now live, burned too many times not to be frightened by the phenomena, so I take no pleasure or vindication in what's happened. But these fires, in a terrible but persistent way, underline the inequalities that govern California today, and the inequalities in terms of housing, of income, and of access to the wild areas of the state. And I recently wrote something called A Tale of Two Fires, contrasting the Paradise Fire, which destroyed 15,000 structures and killed almost 100 people, with the Malibu Fire, which destroyed 1,500 structures and killed 3 or 4 people.
Yes, I know that in Paradise, California, I was talking to some folks there, and they said that it was mainly a low-income community, and few had fire insurance. And now, incidentally, Donald Trump wants to cut off FEMA aid to California fire victims. My question, are the poor set up for a big fall as climate-driven disasters roll through these unsustainable lifestyles?
Well, on a global scale, I think we can speak of a kind of tirage and advance that's occurred, that basically contemporary debates on climate change, the huge resistance not only to reducing carbon footprints, but to providing the kind of hundreds of billions of dollars of aid that are necessary to adapt the most vulnerable and exposed communities to inevitable rising sea levels and droughts, and to the loss of agricultural land. Absolutely. It's first and above all a question of the Earth's poor. In California, with the wildfires, which undoubtedly have a component of anthropogenic climate change in their causality, you see two forms of inequality. In Paradise, the case of people who were unable to find housing, priced out of the housing market, even in the Central Valley. The coast has become so unaffordable that Californians have moved into the Central Valley and other inland areas in the search of affordable housing. Many of the people in Paradise can afford even to live in the valley floor. So Paradise became a kind of attractive refuge for people on fixed incomes, for people with large families, and so on. But like Malibu, it shares the distinction of being a fire corridor, which time and time again has experienced catastrophic fires. In this case, a community of 25,000 people built on a ridge overlooking the gorge of the Feather River and backed by a notorious wind gap in the Sierras, where annually winds will come at 40, 50, even 70, 80 miles an hour. In Malibu, a similar situation in that Malibu is part of a western Santa Monica Mountain topography. The canyon's perfectly aligned to the direction of the seasonal Santa Ana winds. And in Malibu, you've had areas that have been burnt 5, 6 times in the last century. Basically, Malibu burns whenever the brush, the coastal sage and chaparral, is mature enough to burn, which is why I raised the question of why should society subsidize wealthy homeowners in Malibu who have almost unlimited guarantee of fire prevention and firefighting resources in a landscape that simply wants to burn and will burn. There have been 7 or 8 major Malibu fires in my lifetime. But you can contrast the two situations. In Paradise, people with low incomes are unable to really live anywhere else. And in Malibu, people with extraordinary high incomes, but most of all with formidable political clout, able to afford to rebuild time and time again, and with the guarantee that government will put all the firefighting resources it can on the line to defend their homes. A very different situation from Paradise, where all of this was circumscribed by a county budget deficit and fiscal crisis, which, for instance, prevented the widening or the building of other escape routes from this community, which had grown so rapidly in the last 20 years.
So if we want to educate ourselves about your work, should we begin with something like City of Quartz, Excavating the Future of Los Angeles? And what is the relationship between that book and the Ecology of Fear book 2 years later?
Well, one of the principal themes of City of Quartz are the consequences of unregulated speculative real estate markets on the form, the quality of life, and the democracy of Los Angeles. I engaged these issues principally in a chapter on power in Los Angeles, another chapter on the biggest social movement in Los Angeles during the 1980s and early 1990s, which were homeowners associations attempting to control growth in their communities and to protect or expand their home equity. And Ecology of Fear, the subsequent book, kind of second installment in my LA writing, I face the issue directly and show that in virtually every generation, Southern California has had prophets and visionaries who clearly saw the problems that existed at the nexus between urbanization and Southern California's wild environment, and who advocated a different model of urbanization based on greater equality of housing, but also on controlled growth that would preserve agricultural areas and ban development in the mountains. And this fire chapter talks on one hand about Malibu and their almost limitless entitlements, and on the other hand, by fire syndrome that seems now finally to have been eliminated in the city. But Los Angeles has a terrible history of tenement fires, often producing death tolls in double figures. And again, as in the case of Paradise, the fire protection available was dictated solely by city budgets and investment in fire services without the kind of federal and state entitlements that wealthy communities on the coast possess. So it's been a kind of persistent theme. I've also dwelt at great length, and in fact this explains the title of Ecology of Fear, on the systematic confusion between the social and the natural in Southern California. And I wrote it at a time when people were referring to mountain lions in the hills, comparing them to gang members and talking about wilding gangs and predatory youth as if they were dangerous animals in the city. And so much of the confusion in the identity and practices of Southern California are rooted in basic misunderstandings of the nature of environmental processes and our particular, you know, Mediterranean climate, where environmental change doesn't come seasonally in small amounts in the kind of uniformitarian way that's characteristic of, say, New England or Great Britain, but occurs in occasional bursts, which all the kind of energy of climate and erosion and, you know, an earthquake concentrated into moments which strike people as being catastrophes. when in fact there's simply the normal metabolism, well familiar to anyone else who lives in a Mediterranean environment in southern Europe, Cape area in South Africa, Western Australia, Chile, and so on.
Yes, I left Los Angeles in 1971 after the deadly earthquake then and never really looked back, but I still love the city. I want to move on to your year 2000 book, The Late Victorian Holocausts, and it's one of the few platforms I've found that is willing to discuss an inevitable mass death in our future. And I think we came close when Russia closed grain exports during the 2010 heat emergency and a third of Pakistan was underwater. Do you think famine will return, but this time to a vastly larger population?
Yes, I mean, and we can see this already. It's very legible, dramatically so, in the case of the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East, where epic drought and huge stresses on water supply have been integral parts of the social turbulence and violence in Iraq, in Syria, and certainly in Afghanistan. Then a drastic decrease in food security, whole areas, agricultural areas, basically been put out of commission. And the major studies of the future of drought, particularly those conducted by scientists at Lamont Doherty, the Earth Observatory of Columbia University, one of the two or three major centers of climate research, show that things will only get worse and that the water deficit in the eastern Mediterranean will increase. A particular concern is the largest irrigated agricultural society on Earth, which is the valley of the Indus River. And a lot of reports show that the water supply from the Hindu Kush and the Pamirs, basically the western part of the the Himalayas, as glaciers melt and as conditions change more rapidly there than, for instance, in the central plateau of Tibet, we're talking about reduced water availability in an area where you have, 90 million people dependent on the Indus to sustain agriculture. Similarly, the Punjab, the immigrants fleeing Honduras and Guatemala these days are driven not only by political violence and by corrupt governments, but also by drought. The Caribbean and Central America, another area that has been focused on by these studies. And finally, in the larger picture, to accommodate the Earth's population by mid-century, when we reach the final build-out of human population, it will never get bigger, we have to increase, almost double the food supply, increase it by 50%, yet at the same time, facing these huge threats posed by diminishing water resources. Groundwater, of course, has reached far beyond the crisis level, even in innumerable parts of the world, Mexico City being a famous example, running out of the groundwater on which it relies. So we're obviously headed toward a major global crisis that conflates environmental change and disasters like floods that are one of the effects of global warming with threats to some of the most important agricultural areas on Earth, and Africa, of course, being another example. Some studies show actually the Sahara may get suddenly more rain, but the larger problem is that the Green Revolution has never really arrived in Africa, and that's more of a political and social problem, a problem of ruling elites and corrupt governments. But climate change and the return of epic droughts in parts of Africa, as we see already in Somalia, will worsen that. It's impossible to address climate change without addressing the politics of climate change. And in this sense, my book, Late Victorian Holocaust, was an effort to understand that in countries, that regions that had experienced for thousands of years periodic major droughts, why suddenly under enlightened British rule and with building railroads and canals and so on, the death toll suddenly shot up and one of the greatest mortality events in human history in the 1870s and again in the 1890s. And here you have to look not just to climate events, but to the way that water is stored, managed, distributed, and particularly the kind of resources managed or controlled by communities themselves, which were stripped away in the conquest of India and its integration in the world market by the British Empire in the 19th century.
From California, my guest is the well-known urban historian, author, and lefty environmentalist Mike Davis. I read your 2006 book, Planet of the Slums, Urban Involution and Informal Working Class. Do you see slum anger tearing down the system? And if so, can it build something new?
Well, we have to build something new. We're starting right now. I mean, the level of content of political debate around the world basically excludes about a quarter of humanity. The urgency of their needs just aren't factored in at all. And, of course, the countries whose industrial economies have created global warming will suffer far less than countries which, for political reasons, and above all to colonialism and empire, haven't developed and whose share of global warming is very small. The burden of adjustment is entirely placed on them. And I don't think anybody can realistically look at where political discussion and action is going and have real hope that existing socioeconomic relations in any way guarantee human survival. In fact, everywhere the gates are being raised, moats being done, Trump's tyrannic proposal for a border wall is a perfect symbol of what's happening globally. That's why I've argued that we must start not from what is realistic, not what governments can agree in meetings in Paris, but what is necessary to ensure the survival and decent quality of life for every human being on the planet. And, of course, this is utopian, not because the resources and the technology exist, but because the power relations that stand in the way of that. So we have to imagine a revolution of a new kind and something that happens globally. And, of course, it would be foolish to try and specify in detail what that means. The first test is to create a body of opinion throughout the world that is absolutely committed to human survival as a whole and to restoring some balance between the metabolism of our urban societies and that of the natural world. Now, I often argue that discussions of climate crisis disguise or hide another crisis which intimately linked to the climate crisis and equally important, and that's simply the fact that global branded capitalism is no longer creating jobs for the larger part of the new cohorts of workers around the world, the new generations. Planet of Slums focused on so-called informal sector, people who are excluded from the global economy in any meaningful way, that scrape by through huge variety of the so-called informal acts, whether that's rummaging in a, you know, enormous garbage heap or pulling rickshaws or standing in front of Home Depot in the hope of getting a day's work as a gardener. I mean, the paradox for people on the left is that capitalism is no longer exploiting hundreds of millions of people, meaning that part of humanity, again, has become surplus to the global economy. And therefore, because it's also largely unorganized and has no political voice, vulnerable to the kind of decimations that we can only too easily imagine in the future.
Mike, you have defined yourself as a Marxist environmentalist. Can you talk to us about that?
I'm a socialist environmentalist. I recently wrote a book on Marx kind of to explain that I agree with Marx, who said he was not a Marxist, at least in the sense that some of his followers intended. And also, you say you're a Marxist often identifies you as associated with the academy, with Marxist thought. First and above all, identify myself as a socialist. and the belief that the people of the world have to democratically control and utilize socialized systems of production for the benefit of all. I'm extremely old-fashioned in that sense. I still believe labor should rule the earth. And that's why I always insist on calling myself a socialist more than a Marxist. Other people call me a Marxist. But to be honest with you, a lot of Marxists don't like my stuff at all.
So what do you think of the mythology that maybe a few billionaires, you know, Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett will wake up and they'll see the ecological danger, the climate danger, and they'll start investing to save us?
Well, there's a precedent for that. In the early Depression, just after the inauguration of Franklin Roosevelt, a group of the most powerful corporate leaders in the country, and in this period of the American economic history, many corporate leaders were actually electrical engineers, like Jared Swope, the head of GE, and far more visionary than any of the current crop of capitalists, including the Silicon Valley type. And they realized that the Depression was at least partially the cause of lack of effective demand in the economy. To put it simply, auto workers weren't paid enough to afford to buy automobiles themselves. So they set out a plan that became the notorious NRA, National Recovery Administration, where industry would voluntarily agree to raise wages, in return would be allowed to set prices, pull the country out of depression. But as soon as workers began to take advantage of this and organize, and as soon as competitors refused to join the effort, it entirely collapsed and fell apart. And so even the most enlightened industrial managers were forced back to their individual bottom lines. I've argued that, in a sense, the movements of 3 or 4 years ago, the Occupy movements, were wrongheaded to stress so exclusively economic inequality. Even if you took all the fortunes of the billionaires and redistributed them, it wouldn't address the core problem. And the core problem is the concentration of economic power. That is the ability to make decisions that affect the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, to make those as private decisions on criteria of individual interests or those as shareholders, that this concentration of economic power is the problem. We have to talk about economic power, how to democratize it, and how to subordinate technological change and these vast international networks of production to human needs and to the needs of adapting our environments to a changing nature. And in a sense, there's a virtuous circle hidden with all this, because if you buy my argument that capitalism is failing in the largest sense to create jobs for people worldwide, our current system, it's through adaptation and massive work of rebuilding our cities on green foundations that should give jobs back to tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people. When I speak to environmental groups, as I once did regularly, I always told them that there should be no environmental demand, no demand about saving the Santa Monica Mountains, for example, or creating a national park, that didn't at the same time address youth unemployment in the inner cities and involve, you know, some quotient of job creation. And it's as much the fault of environmentalists as their enemies that environmental conservation has been pitted against jobs. Environmentalists should be the most ardent advocates of employment, full employment policies.
You chronicled, as we discussed, how the British colonial system milked India, setting the stage for mass poverty. But now I see what appears to be the last vestige of communist rule in China, setting up kind of the same deal as they buy out vast farmlands in South America and Africa. Is there a big difference?
No, I don't think so. I mean, of course, China's urban industrial revolution, the largest in world history, it's an extraordinary phenomenon, only made possible by the competence married to the immense power of the Chinese Communist Party. But I would argue vehemently against the idea that China is anyway a socialist country or that its Communist Party actually advances any of the principles of communism. Its staggering growth has produced huge new inequalities. It has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, but it's also deepened the wealth gap very dramatically. And the very essence of socialism is that working people themselves should exercise economic democracy. There's no way that you can really disassociate socialism and democracy. And the fact that that's so often the perception is, of course, the result of Stalinism and a variety of nationalist regimes, revolutionary regimes that have called themselves, you know, Marxist or socialist, but in practice have been something else. You know, in the case of China, I mean, China is succeeding in some very important environmental tasks like reforestation. But at the same time, the pressure, particularly over the last 5 years, to develop land at urban fringes, land that actually is not really needed since China's been immensely overbuilding, particularly residences for people unaffordable by most Chinese, and trying to set up new industrial zones. It's tremendous infrastructural investment, which accrue to the profits of district officials and developers at the expense of farmland, which is needlessly converted, unnecessarily converted, basically into vacant land for future development. And it's, you know, tremendous stresses. And obviously, it's become a problem in terms of Chinese goals of achieving food sufficiency. So, like the Gulf countries and Saudi Arabia, it's turned to creating its own, basically, agricultural colonies elsewhere to export food. Chinese have been brilliant around the world in taking control of markets and primary materials, raw materials, buying up everything they can and encouraging investment and sometimes lending the money to create massive overcapacity so that the consumer, China in this case, has power, has dominance over its suppliers in Brazil or, you know, Africa and other parts of Asia. This is an unsustainable system. And whereas there certainly is some sort of Chinese miracle, there's no evidence in my mind that Chinese ruling elites are really capable of dealing with and surmounting the great problems of where economics and the environment and environmental change intersect.
Well, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I have to ask you, what are you working on these days, Mike Davis?
Well, I'm working on two things with John Wiener, well-known to many listeners as the biographer of John Lennon. We're just finishing a very large, very long book, maybe 700 pages or more, A History of Los Angeles in the 1960s. And I'm also now working on a kind of strange project called The Big Red Scrapbook, Paper Memories of Revolution and Anti-Colonialism, where I'm using basically found objects, letters, postcards, money, stamps, and assembling them much like a scrapbook and letting the objects themselves tell stories, particularly about parts of political and revolutionary history that are little known. And these are going to be mounted on the website of Verso Books in kind of weekly or biweekly installments. And I have 150 of these stories, so who knows how long that may go on.
I'm going to look for it for sure. From the University of California, Riverside, we've been speaking with the author, teacher, and activist Mike Davis. You can find links to his books and the articles we have discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mike, it was sincerely great to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. I began this program by asking if we should give up and party. You must know by now, we can't give up this rich planet and a decent life for all coming generations.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, We shall never surrender until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
But I don't think that means we can't enjoy ourselves. Feeling joy is more important now than ever. Let's feel joy about nature and about each other. Let's feel good about the people we meet in the struggle, the parties after the action, the love. Let's enjoy and save the climate, too. Find all our past shows for free download at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you for not giving up.
You are listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
But the anti-Semitism thing has just kept coming back. But this whole narrative of crisis is really invented. It's invented, you know, it's exaggerated, and it's outright fabricated in many cases. And it just literally, the first headlines about it were literally just invented. Like, it was, and there's been no accounting for that.
Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. And we are experimenting with a brand new format for the podcast. I'm really excited to have my colleague of nearly 10 years, Asa Wynn-Stanley of the Electronic Intifada, joining me as co-host. How serious do you think people, not politicians, are taking this so-called crisis, this manufactured crisis of anti-Semitism in the UK?
That's a good question, and it's something that I actually want to look into a bit more. I think, as far as I've seen, there's only been one recent poll actually about the population's opinion of the so-called anti-Semitism crisis in the Labour Party. I believe, I may be wrong on this, but I think it was commissioned by the Jewish Chronicle, which is... it wasn't always, but it's now an incredibly right-wing pro-Zionist newspaper. I think it was commissioned by the Jewish Chronicle. So from that extent, I would take it with a pinch of salt. But it did, I believe it had a plurality of people who believed there was some sort of issue in the Labour Party there. But, I mean, it's something I need to look at a bit more closely. But in terms of the polling for the Labour Party membership itself, it's rejected. Like, most people sort of say that, you know, yes, there's anti-Semitism, but it's wrong to say it's any higher in the Labour Party than any other party. And it's broadly rejected. And I think, I mean, just anecdotally, and my impression in general is just that people are just kind of, just general, in terms of general population, people are just kind of bored by it, really, and just sort of thinking that, what is this, and confused as well, because the thing is as well that it is a really damaging thing, and it is actually a damaging thing to real principled anti-racism and to fight fight against actual anti-Semitism, because people then do get Israel and Jews and Jewish people, Jewish communities conflated together. You know,
that's right.
And if Israel sort of presents itself as what it called, you know, what Netanyahu once called, you know, didn't he call himself like the prime minister of the Jewish people in France? Like,
yes, he did. The leader of the Jewish people. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what a fucking cheek. Like, who? I mean, if I was Jewish, I would think, like, I didn't vote for you, you know, sort of thing.
I never got a ballot on that one.
Yeah, it's like it's despicable. Like it's laughable, but it's also like really, it is really damaging, because like people do think, oh well, you know, that it becomes conflated, you know, and to a greater extent even that, like, I mean, I suppose people do conflate to a certain extent Muslims with, you know, despotic states like Saudi Arabia, or, you know, so there is like Islamophobia, where people are sort of confused and think that, like, I don't know, these Saudi princes who are just like the worst people in the world sort of represent true Islam or like that Muslims support ISIS. There was again, The Sun a few years ago had this horrible, like really fake news headline where they said that most Muslims in the UK support ISIS. It was complete nonsense. Like it was just rubbish. It was a load of rubbish when you actually looked at the figures. But I think with Israel, it's far greater actually the conflation, and that's a really negative thing. And that the main culprit for the main responsibility of that lies with Israel, because they present themselves as the so-called Jewish state, you know, and we don't accept that for ISIS, like that they are the Islamic state. Like, why should we accept it for? Why do we accept it for Israel? And yes, I am comparing ISIS to Israel.
Asa, you mentioned a few minutes ago the Israel Project and the way that these, mostly online campaigns run covertly and overtly to insert Israel's narrative or to discredit, you know, politicians who say that Palestinians shockingly should deserve equal rights. The Israel Project, of course, was a main focus of the Al Jazeera investigation, the Lobby USA. Can you talk a little bit about how your investigation with the so-called labor anti-Semitism crisis merges with these patterns that you're seeing by these covert Israel lobbyists running these social media campaigns, and really how the revelations in that Al Jazeera investigative documentary continue to kind of put pieces into place here when we're looking at the whole picture?
Yeah, so that's kind of a big question then, Aura. I think...
Sorry.
But yeah, I mean, it all ties together. Like, this is the thing. Like, so the Israel Project is an ostensibly American pro-Israeli propaganda organization, which just pumps out basically, you know, laughable drivel on how great Israel is and just stupid memes and things like that. But what the Lobby USA, Al Jazeera's censored documentary, showed was that they were involved in this covert campaign to influence Facebook users. So what they did was they set up a bunch of Facebook pages which posted there, which on the surface had nothing to do with Israel. They were just stupid things about. Just like some pink sort of page, like
right, donuts and
yeah, just like ostensibly liberal feminism, but just right. Like, hey, look how great women are, sort of thing. But then just like 25% of it, they sneak in like, oh, Golda Meir, she was girl power, you know, 50 years ago, just nonsense like that, basically, and. And it had, no doubt it had an effect. I mean, can I just go off on like a side tangent rant here? Like,
please,
like,
please.
I've been waiting. Really annoys me about like some leftists like who really are really down on the term the Israel Lobby. Okay, and it actually really annoys me. Like, okay, I get like the critiques of Walton Meshema and all this stuff. Okay. You know, I understand there's limits to the term Israel Lobby. You know, I get that. But, like, there seems to be, like, a move afoot to, like, just basically ban that term. And it actually really annoys me because, like, it's a simple two-word term which accurately describes what they do. There's, you know, cigarette lobby. Why wouldn't there be an Israel lobby? And, like, yeah, okay, maybe it doesn't... It definitely doesn't have as much power as it claims to. Like, it's not as it propagandizes itself. It says, oh, you know, it tries to portray itself as like this all powerful thing, the Israel lobby. That's how it's trying to present itself. Like, it's in the interest of every lobby to do that. Okay. But like, to say like they don't have an influence is stupid. It's like putting your fingers in your ears and say, oh, it's kind of a hippie-ish argument, if you ask me. It's like sort of hippies who say, oh, well, adverts don't influence me, you know, sort of thing. And like, well, they wouldn't put billions of dollars into advertising if it didn't have any effect. Do you know what I mean? So at the same time, the Israel lobby has an effect. Like, of course it does. Like, they wouldn't pour these millions into it if it didn't. You know, like, Sheldon Adelson is going to demand, like, certain results for all the, you know. So, like,
yeah, he didn't just pour $50 million of his own money into nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a little bit of quid pro quo there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so, yeah, there's two sides to it. Like, at the same time, they quite often admit how they're, you know, they're kind of wasting their money and they're not getting the results that they want. But it does have an effect. Like, in the case of the Israel project, like, as I mentioned a bit earlier, there was some of these pages. I think it was from one of the pages which was about history, just like, oh, this day on history, so and such a thing happened. It was some video, and it was about Jerusalem, and it got, I think, 10 million views or something, you know. And so this was going around, and that one was actually about Jerusalem and how, I think it was about how UNRWA, UNESCO, the UN cultural agency, you know, was supposedly trying to wipe out the Jewish connection to Jerusalem and all that, and you know. So what they did with these pages, and what they're still doing, because despite us exposing it, and Al Jazeera, you know, when we leaked Al Jazeera's documentary, Facebook has refused to take action against these pages. So they're still doing these kinds of things. They're infiltrating a pro-Israel narrative into, like, these seemingly innocuous pages. And actually, when I looked at some of these pages, I did see some of my Facebook friends had liked these pages, just thinking, oh, you know, just like a silly thing you follow online, not realizing what it actually was. So that's what the kind of things that they're up to. And there was a lot in those films, and I think they are hugely significant. And I think there's a lot still to me that needs to come out of the US one in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like they just kind of hit the tip of the iceberg there. And it was just 4 hours, but those 4 hours were a lot, and it was a start.
Yeah, I feel like we still haven't processed it ourselves, because we were like so busy trying to leak it and leaking it that we haven't like covered it to the extent that we covered the UK one, because Al Jazeera actually managed to release that one themselves. But it will... The UK one has been, since it was aired, it was 2 years ago now, wow. It's been like a constant resource for me, personally, in my reporting, and I know it's been for others as well. So I think the US one will be that as well.
So all of this evidence has come out. Your investigative report is making the rounds on social media. Has there been any response by Corbyn's office or any other members of the Labour Party? You end your piece with this great sentence: when the dominant media narrative is so often based on fabricated evidence, a serious reappraisal and extreme caution about future claims are overdue. Do you feel like that is, there is going to be some sort of appraisal of these claims and some sort of party line that Labour should make about these false accusations and this really concerted effort to tear Labour apart right now?
No, in a word, it's not going to happen. Like, I don't see, like, it's like I've just been plugging away at it, like, for, well, we're in 2019 now, 4 years, I suppose, 3.5 years. Yeah, I mean, I don't see it happening, unfortunately, sad to say. Like, I mean, it's not believed by the people, but the politicians either believe it or at least, like, they have to give lip service to it. This is the thing. Even when they don't believe it, it's like they can't say it publicly because they're afraid of being targeted and singled out themselves. Because the crisis and the witch hunt is so, it's in such a frenzy like even to say, well, actually, it's not happening, or it's exaggerated, or even to ask for evidence, that in itself is singled out as an example of anti-Semitism. So if you just say, like, oh, well, I don't believe that Labour's an institutionally anti-Semitic party, you'll get people, right-wing Labour Party councillors, right-wing, you'll get JLM, Jewish Labour Movement, which is a very incredibly pro-Israel group, people on Twitter trying to start up a Twitter storm that will get the attention of blue tick journalists, say, oh, the Labour Party anti-Semitism crisis has come back. And it, what they do, it's a bit like wolves or hyenas singling someone out from the pack, because they then pounce on them and they try and isolate people, pick them off one by one, so they get suspended from the Labour Party. And people are terrified of that, you know, especially people who've been in it for a long time, or they've got, you know, if they're, you know, a left-wing Labour council or a left-wing Labour MP, they keep their heads down and they don't say anything. You know, there's one or two people like Chris Williamson who've actually said, you know, this is exaggerated. You know, he said, I'm not saying it never happens, but it's just it's a really nasty sort of dirty tricks campaign. And then they're trying to single him out, you know, and trying to go for him, trying to manufacture a sort of outrage where witch hunt is the most appropriate description of it, because it's just like it's there in the media and it reaches a thing where it's just at certain points it's reached a stage of being in headlines every day where people can't stand up to it. And people then at the top, and it goes, unfortunately, it does go all the way to Jeremy Corbyn's office, where there's this dynamic where they just think, oh, well, we've got to think of the greater movement. So they don't think of it in this way, but we'll just throw them under the bus, basically. Oh, we can sacrifice one or two people. Oh, you know, if they just sort of get suspended now, we can bring them back later, kind of thing, when there's been a hearing. But and that kind of, and you can see the temptation of that. But that dynamic has only like fueled this whole thing, where instead of saying, well, actually, where's the evidence for this? It's just accepted as, ah, well, you know, there's no smoke without fire kind of thing. And the very beginnings of it in Oxford University Labour Club were an outright fabrication. It was literally a right-wing pro-Israel student who were later left the Labour Party and joined the Lib Dems, who was saying, oh, well, look, the student Labour Club is endorsing Israeli Apartheid Week. That is anti-Semitism. You know, and that's where it all came from. That was the origins of it. You know, that was the first example of accusations of institutional anti-Semitism, so-called institutional anti-Semitism. That's the evidence. It's no evidence at all. You know, it's actually evidence of a campaign of fabrication and defamation is what it is. And people are unfortunately quite often too afraid to say that, even though they more often than not know it's the truth. People on the left, anyway. So, no, unfortunately, unless there's like a change of strategy from the leadership's office where they say, well, actually, we're going to just start calling this out for what it is. I don't see it. I just see it coming back and back time and time again, because it has a degree of effectiveness in sabotaging the movement.
If you could sit down with Jeremy Corbyn again, I know you did a few years ago.
Yeah.
What advice would you give him right now?
Like, stand up to them, like, stop capitulating, because if you're making the argument that, say, oh, well, you know, we can't let this one issue derail everything else. Oh, yeah. Okay. I can see that argument. Right. But what has been the record of that for 3.5 years? What has been the record of that? Has conceding to them made them stop these false allegations? No. It's had the opposite effect. It just keeps coming back time and time again. And it's like, aside from all those sort of pragmatic arguments, like, this is the wrong thing to do. Like, why are you just allowing people to be sort of thrown under the bus where people like Ken Livingston, maybe... you know, they didn't say the most politic things, but nothing Ken Livingston said to me was anti-Semitic. He was talking about the historical connections between the German Zionist movement in the 1930s and Nazi government. Like, it happened. It's a historical fact. Like, Ken Livingston, you know, why should he have been expelled from the Labour Party for saying a fact, even if it was an inconvenient fact? And he wasn't expelled in the end, he quit. But, you know, it was a sad indictment of a movement, really, to me. But I guess my main advice to Jeremy Corbyn would be, like, yeah, stand up to them. Like, there's no other way out of it. You've got to knock it on the head.
Asa, your report is called Fake Labor Accounts Fueling Anti-Semitism Crisis. It's up now on the Electronic Intifada, electronicintifada.net. We'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned. Well, Asa, thank you so much for that. And again, if people want to learn more about your report, they can go to EI, of course, electronicintifada.net. The piece is Fake Labor Accounts Fueling Anti-Semitism Crisis by Asa Winstanley. Asa, thank you so much. This is going to be really fun going forward, having you as co-host on the EI podcast.
Yeah, I'm excited.
And of course, you can support us on iTunes, or now it's called Apple Podcasts. Just search for the Electronic Intifada. Leave us a 5-star review, of course.
Donate to electronicintifada.net.
That's right. Electronicintifada.net. Asa, thank you so much.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sanaa Abrar of United We Dream, who discusses her group's current campaign to pressure Congress to defund ICE and U.S. Customs and Border Protection in order to disable the U.S. Trump Deportation Force. Panayoti Solkas of the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons, who examines the links between environmental justice and mass incarceration. And Anthony Rogers Wright of the Center for Sustainable Economy, who assesses the proposed federal Green New Deal resolution in Congress and parallel campaigns to win Green New Deal initiatives at the state and local level. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In his first days as Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known affectionately as AMLO, proposed a Marshall-like aid plan for the impoverished and violence-plagued nations of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. AMLO committed to investing $30 billion in the three Central American nations over 5 years. López Obrador, who ran on a bold, progressive agenda in Mexico's election last July, plans to move more resources into regional development rather than security in order to slow the flow of migrants moving north into Mexico and the U.S. Obrador's initiative won praise from the United Nations Commission on Latin America, but has not been supported by the Trump administration. Many progressives in Latin America support AMLO's aims, but are skeptical that it can fundamentally reshape the lives among Central America's poor citizens. Jeff Thale of the Washington Office on Latin America opined it's a long way from saying it's a good idea for a regional economic plan to mobilizing resources and get free of corruption and mismanagement. ProPublica reports executives at pharmaceutical giant Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, which helped to trigger the U.S. opioid crisis, considered capitalizing on the addiction treatment market, while at the same time trying to boost sales of their controversial opioid drug. ProPublica's review of the civil complaint revealed that members of the Sackler family, which controls Purdue Pharma, pushed for higher doses of OxyContin, guided efforts to mislead doctors and the public about the drug's addictive capacity, blaming misuse on patients. The complaint alleges that the concerns about doctors improperly prescribing the drug and patients becoming addicted were swept aside in an aggressive effort to drive OxyContin sales ever higher. The Sackler family is well known for its philanthropy in the art world, but now a group of activists has called on organizations to stop accepting Sackler contributions and for the family name to be stripped from some institutions. Aggressive marketing of OxyContin is blamed by some analysts for propelling the crisis that has resulted in 200,000 overdose deaths related to prescription opioids since 1999. In launching her presidential campaign, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has revived the idea of a wealth tax on America's super rich. The progressive Democrat calls for imposing a 2% tax on households worth over $50 million and 3% on assets above $1 billion, affecting only 75,000 households. The proposal provoked an outcry from billionaires Michael Bloomberg and Howard Schultz, both of whom have presidential aspirations. In contrast to discussion of a wealth tax, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is proposing to repeal the already weakened federal estate tax that impacts fewer than 2,000 of the nation's wealthiest families a year. Many Democratic Party policy advisors believe that a wealth tax has wide public appeal. Gene Sperling, who worked for Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, declared wealth inequality in our country is a national scandal. Seth Hanlon of the Center for American Progress praised Warren for proposing something bold to get at our tax code's failure to tax major accumulations of wealth. According to the New Yorker magazine, two University of California at Berkeley economists say Warren's wealth tax would generate $2.75 trillion over a decade, even with a predicted increase in tax avoidance behavior among the super rich. Warren's tax proposal also calls for a significant increase in the IRS tax enforcement budget and a minimum audit rate for wealthy households subject to the new levy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After the longest government shutdown in U.S. history ended on January 25th, another deadline loomed on February 15th. Democratic and Republican congressional negotiators said on February 11th that they had reached a budget agreement in principle to prevent another government shutdown by funding border security, while including no money for President Trump's proposed southern border wall. Mr. Trump could accept the bipartisan deal while still retaining the option to issue an executive order declaring a national emergency in order to bypass Congress to get border wall funding. But as budget talks continued, United We Dream, the largest immigrant youth-led organization in the country, pressed their campaign to defund U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and U.S. Immigration and Border Protection, CBP, federal agencies that the activist group describes as Trump's deportation force. In their new report titled The Truth About ICE and CBP, United We Dream describes the constant violent abuses that immigrant youth, children, and their families suffer at the hands of these agencies every day. Your reporter spoke with Sanaa Abrar, United We Dream's advocacy director, who talks about the report and the reasons why her group is now pressuring Congress to defund these immigration enforcement agencies.
One example of a story that we've included in this report, which is available at thedeportationforce.com, is the story of Miguel. Miguel is a New Jersey resident. He's also a DACA recipient. He was on his way to get coffee in the morning in his car, and he was blocked at the end of a road in his own neighborhood by unmarked vehicles. Two individuals came out of the vehicles, and they identified themselves as ICE agents. They asked him for his identification. Miguel provided his DACA. They challenged the validity of his DACA, and they actually took him into a detention camp in New Jersey, where he spent a few months actually incarcerated because of ICE. This is a DACA recipient, right? We would understand DACA as being protection from detention and deportation. But unfortunately, his isn't the only story. You know, when we talk about Border Patrol, there have been extremely high-profile cases that have come up in recent months as a result of Border Patrol abuses. One of the stories has been of Jacqueline Call, a very young Guatemalan girl who came to the United States, crossed the border with her father and a group of immigrants who were coming to this country. She ended up dying in Border Patrol custody. And this was partly a result of the conditions of the camp that she was being kept in. There's also the case of Felipe Alonso Munoz, who was in a very similar situation, very young boy who died on Christmas Day in Border Patrol custody. We highlight the cases of many stories and firsthand examples of the abuses of ICE and CBP. This report that we have goes through 144 unique reports from 2018 that basically draws a pattern of not only the abuses of ICE and Border Patrol, but collaboration in certain localities between local law enforcement and ICE. We also do the work of organizing the loved ones of those who are in detention to take action. So, for example, last week, as well as this week, United We Dream is bringing families of individuals in detention to Washington, D.C. to lobby on their behalf. Last week, with the release of this report, we actually had families of detained individuals going from office to office on Capitol Hill, dropping off this report, essentially saying, this is my story. That's the policy, that's the evidence, and these are the stories that you need so that you can understand completely why we need to defund these agencies. And we'll be doing the same this week as well, and ensuring that the stories of those who may be miles and miles away in a detention cell, their stories are still being heard among policymakers and their staff.
What's been the response of congresspeople you've spoken with and your organization has contacted about your pressure being exerted to defund Customs and Border Protection and ICE? There are a lot of people in the country who believe the nation needs a force at the border to regulate immigration. I wonder how you respond to that or how you approach that particular issue with Congress.
I have hope. I can literally feel the winds of change blowing. Last Thursday, we had the great honor of being not only with families of those who have been detained at a press event, but also with Congresswomen Presley, Tlaib, Omar, and Ocasio-Cortez, calling for the defunding of the agencies of ICE and Border Patrol. We've also had success in the past with members signing on to letters calling for reductions in funding for ICE and Border Patrol, both on the House and the Senate side. For example, last year we were able to get the support of about 83 House Democrats onto a letter in 2018 calling for reductions. That same year we were able to get about 20 or so senators to also call for reductions in funding. And those are the tactics that we are continuing to employ and to escalate upon to get members of Congress to understand that they can take action. We are finding that it is becoming increasingly a not only a conversation point, but a battle cry for many members of Congress. So we look forward to continuing to use tools like our report, as well as bringing in families to really explore and expose, honestly, the human consequences of what ICE and Border Patrol are doing, so that members of Congress have the tools that they need to show why it is so necessary to defund these agencies.
That was Sanaa Abrar, Advocacy Director with the immigrant youth-led group United We Dream. Learn more about their campaign to defund federal immigration enforcement agencies and find a copy of their new report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Starting in late January and lasting almost a week, frigid temperatures in the single digits in the Northeast coincided with a breakdown in the heating system at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. More than 1,600 inmates there had no heat, went without hot meals, hot water for showers, or light in their cells. For security reasons, inmates were placed on lockdown in their cells, where the temperatures were the coldest. One inmate reported that a third blanket he was using to try to keep warm was taken away by guards, who said that by regulation, inmates could have no more than two blankets. Family members of prisoners, and others outraged by the situation, rallied daily outside the complex, demanding their loved ones be moved until heat was restored. At one point, a group of protesters were pepper-sprayed by guards. In the end, the prisoners were not moved, but after several days, heat and hot water were restored. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Panayoti Solkas. He co-founded the Prison Ecology Project of the Human Rights Defense Center to research the intersection of the prison system and environmental contamination, as well as the impacts of climate change on penal institutions. Here, Solkas, now an organizer with a campaign to fight toxic prisons, examines the links between environmental justice and mass incarceration.
I track issues with prisons and jails and detention facilities all over the country, overlaps between environmental protection and mass incarceration, and looking at the intersections of climate justice and of pollution and how those things are related to criminal justice and the prison system. And I know from following similar stories all across the country that this is not a rare occasion when power goes out for days or weeks at a time. The extreme weather often is the cause of the major environmental situation, you know, environmental justice issue arising. So in this case, possibly because of a spike in cold weather causing stress on regional utilities, that may have been related. You know, a lot of prison facilities, whether they're new or old, are built with, you know, substandard infrastructure. So the old ones are even worse. Prisons exist almost as this domestic third world captive nation or nation inside, people have referred to. And that exists on many levels, you know, on labor standards. So prisoners work, but they're not protected by basic labor laws. Prisoners face environmental problems that we've been tracking, but it often looks more like the conditions of a maquiladora south of the border, where environmental regulations are either very relaxed or non-existent because what's happening is occurring behind closed doors or on the other side of a fence or a wall. So the situation at MDC, you know, it needs to be put in context, I think, with the national, you know, picture of incarceration in this country. Sadly, it's not shocking. Maybe days or weeks before news broke about the MDC power outages, there was viral videos from Chicago of prison slaves, you know, shoveling snow in like blizzard conditions. Over the course of a year before that, I could point to a dozen cases where prisoners were caught in floods or conditions during or post-hurricane being horrendous on the coast of Florida and South Carolina. Here in Florida, on both coasts of the state, as red tide was sweeping through the Gulf and then circling around the Atlantic, which it rarely does, but extreme weather conditions have affected a lot of weather patterns in ways that are kind of unexpected or unanticipated. And they had prison slaves, you know, picking up toxic dead fish piled up on the shores. So, you know, these are all things to me. These are all intersections of climate justice and prison abolition. And I think it's important to view the atrocities at the Metropolitan Detention Center with that lens. This overlap between environmental justice and mass incarceration is kind of like climaxing as the climate itself is destabilizing. You know, it's increasing numbers of prisoners die from extreme heat every year, but extreme cold should not be neglected.
Panayoti Solkas, as a prison abolitionist, I don't know what your view is about small reform steps, but in this Brooklyn Detention Center case, the warden was criticized for not having an emergency plan in place, like even just giving prisoners extra blankets, if not removing them from their freezing cells altogether.
Well, yeah, I think that's, you know, obvious. As a prison abolitionist, I think, you know, conditions of confinement and daily struggles around reform are the foundation of the movement, you know, how we build networks of support on the inside and outside. And so I think, of course, we have to grapple with these issues as they come and put them in context of fundamental change, ultimately creating a system so distinct that I don't think the same words would even apply. We want to change the criminal justice system so fundamentally that it will be unrecognizable.
Well, people might be wondering what a prison abolitionist thinks about people taking responsibility for their actions and what kind of accountability you think is just.
You know, I guess I view the transition from what we currently have to what we want and what we will have at some point, you know, sooner the harder we push, that communities are empowered to deal with conflict in ways that make sense locally, you know, regionally, culturally. And, of course, this is a criminal justice system that predated nation states and large-scale kind of empire-building governments. So we know it's feasible because it's been done for the thousands of years of recorded history prior to current forms of government that we now see. So I guess I look to that as the model. And I think it still happens in many neighborhoods, you know, especially with youth, where communities come together and you know, deal with a conflict or problem in an attempt to avoid dealing with law enforcement, especially communities that know the repercussions to be so severe and so biased. So I think tapping into that, you know, and understanding how that can and should work, a lot of crime, so-called crime, stems from inequality and injustice, you know, fundamentally. So addressing mental health needs, you know, viewing drugs as a social and health crisis, not a criminal issue. If it weren't for the criminal aspect, I think a lot of the social harm around it would be reduced significantly. So those are things, for example, you know, that I feel like are steps towards the bigger picture of dealing with the crisis at MDC that happened the previous weeks.
That was Panayoti Solkas, an organizer with a campaign to fight toxic prisons. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the months before and after the November 2018 midterm election, discussion and debate on the Green New Deal drew attention to the climate crisis while offering a set of bold policy prescriptions to address climate change. The non-binding joint resolution, sponsored by Democratic Rising Star New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Democratic Senator Edward Markey, lays out a plan for a decade-long mobilization to transform the U.S. economy and move to a carbon-free energy future. The resolution's preamble states that America is in the midst of two crises, a climate crisis and an economic crisis of rising inequality. To address the climate crisis, the resolution spells out 5 goals, 14 projects, and 15 requirements. The measure aims to upgrade the nation's infrastructure, revitalize energy systems, retrofit buildings, and restore ecosystems. As the Green New Deal reduces greenhouse gas emissions, water and air pollution, its sponsors say it would also create millions of new family-sustaining jobs. Those employment opportunities would go first to working-class families and communities of color, as economic disparity in the U.S. has increased. Your reporter spoke with Anthony Rogers Wright, a board member with the Portland, Oregon-based Center for a Sustainable Economy, who assesses the strengths and weaknesses of the proposed federal Green New Deal resolution, with a focus on the need to halt the development of new fossil fuel infrastructure.
First and foremost, you know, kudos to the activists and the organizers on the ground who, you know, push for this and have gotten it to the point that it's at. It's also important for people to understand that what was introduced by Representative Ocasio-Cortez as well as Senator Markey is not policy. It's not a bill as much as it's a resolution and a very bold and forward-thinking mission statement. And that's not to diminish the need for a very bold mission statement coming from people's government as it pertains to addressing the climate crisis, which, of course, is a quintessential threat, not just to the United States, but the entire world. But it's just for people to understand that even if, you know, the president saw the light and did sign it, you know, it would still be equivalent if you will, to the Paris Climate Accords, which are not legally enforceable, right? At the same time, you know, there are some issues with it in that it did leave out mention of a getting the country off of fossil fuels altogether. And it also left the door open for potentially the use of nuclear energy, as the language of the resolution really just focuses on net zero emissions, right? And the problem with that is that it opens the door up for the concept or the idea of a Green New Deal to be co-opted. For instance, in my home state, I live in Seattle now, but grew up in New York City. In my home state, Governor Cuomo just introduced his version of the Green New Deal, which does in fact include the use of nuclear power. So you can see that we're already having a bit of an issue on what the overarching paradigm is, you know, as to, hey, this would qualify as a Green New Deal, and this set of policies would not. So I think that what this is really opening the door to is something that I've actually been advocating for as it pertains to climate policy in general, is that this is really going to have to be a bottom-up process led by local grassroots organizing, especially groups representing frontline communities like the Climate Justice Alliance, like Got Green in Seattle, Front and Centered in Seattle, Opal in Portland, and other frontline groups throughout the country. And I think that that's a really, really good thing, because I think the people do have a lot more power at the local level. Like for instance, I wrote a letter to my governor, Jay Inslee, about my concerns with his leadership on climate change. And wouldn't you know it, I have a meeting with him this Friday morning as a result.
Anthony, in the Green New Deal resolution as it's proposed, is there an explicit call for a moratorium on fossil fuel infrastructure? In other words, things like new natural gas pipelines, fracking, and all the rest. Is there an explicit call to end the public investment into these infrastructure projects, which will last another generation?
Right. No, there is not. And that is why, while it's being applauded by amazing groups like the Climate Justice Alliance, which includes the Indigenous Environmental Network, who both said that, you know, this framework overall is very, very good, yet we are very concerned about the fact that it is not calling for this outright moratorium by X amount of time of fossil fuel infrastructure. And this is completely different than the Green New Deal, but two of the better climate policies that have been released in so many years. A senator in Oregon right now, as a matter of fact, Jeff Merkley's 100 by 50 Act, which did call for a fossil fuel moratorium by 2050. And then, of course, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, who is now running for president, her Off Fossil Fuels Act called for a moratorium on new fossil fuel infrastructure even sooner. And this is really important because SEEN, the organization I'm on the board of, as well as their sister organization, Center for Sustainable Economy, one of our strategies for really addressing this is a fossil fuel risk bonds, which we're hoping would be so expensive that people would just not bother with constructing and trying to permit new fossil fuel infrastructure, as well as an outright fossil fuel moratorium, similar to what was passed, as I said previously, in Portland, Oregon, and more recently in King County, Washington.
Anthony, I did want to ask you about what has been accomplished by your organization in King County, Washington. Tell us a bit about the fossil fuel moratorium that you and your organization were able to pass there and its immediate and long-term effects.
In terms of what we accomplished in King County, amazing local organizing, you know, groups like 350 Seattle, as well as groups like Front and Centered and Got Green. What happened was that we were able to get county commissioners to vote for a six-month moratorium. And within that 6 months, take part and commence studies. It's limited in scope to some extent, and it certainly also gives people, you know, time to keep organizing and to keep the pressure on to their county commissioners, while also sending a message to other counties in Washington State to hopefully follow suit.
That was Anthony Rogers Wright, a board member with the Portland, Oregon-based Center for Sustainable Economy. Learn more about the center's initiatives on halting public funding for fossil fuel infrastructure by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines,
a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado, KODX in Seattle, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Radical politics. I'm often amused when I read, hear, or see a politician criticize his opponents as radical. That's meant to isolate his opponent as somehow weird. But guess what? Radicals are as common as crabgrass in American history. That's because without radicals, how could the nation be born, based as it was, on militant opposition to British kings? At the time, Europe was dominated by hereditary royalty. And after the U.S. Civil War, the radicals were the Republicans, who opposed slavery and fought for black votes, while the Democrats were the party of the Ku Klux Klan. So radicals fought for freedom from kings and from slavery. In 1877, Republican presidential candidate Rutherford Hayes sold out black Republicans and black Southerners to allow Democratic ascendancy and political autonomy. The army left the South, and blacks were exposed to white terrorism again. Radicalism, it seems, only went so far. In the 1960s, blacks embarked on a radical freedom struggle, north and south. Predictably, they were again betrayed, often headed by Republican politicians. Radicals like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, like Malcolm X, Huey Newton, and thousands of others fought for black freedom. Others fought for an end to the Vietnam War. The point? Radicals and revolutionaries fought for freedom from all kinds of oppression. And the last I looked, that was a good thing. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Rebel lawyers, dear friends at Yale Law School, dear rebel lawyers on the move, I greet you all as I endeavor to address the issue of rebel lawyers. When I think of the term, the first thing that comes to mind are jailhouse lawyers. They are, by definition, rebels who oppose the prison industrial complex, especially in the courts. Jailhouse lawyers fight for freedom for themselves and others, and sometimes they prevail. Some jailhouse lawyers, like John and Mo Africa of the Moo Organization, defended themselves at trial and won acquittals. Because such men and women aren't trained in the law and do their work using logic and sheer will, they fall under the description of rebel lawyers, I think. But I've got a feeling that this isn't what students at Yale Law think of when they use the term. If you're really interested in that subject, I urge you to see my book, Jailhouse Lawyers. Let us return to rebel lawyers, but with a peculiar twist. That's because I'm speaking here of two revolutionary leaders who went to law school, but found that the law and the systems that they lived under were so corrupt, so biased, so dominated by unjust political elites that they learned that their very society had to be radically transformed before the law could be functional. I speak of two men who are rarely thought of as lawyers, even though both studied law, and one even briefly practiced it. I speak of Fidel Castro and Nelson Mandela. Castro went to law school under the Cuban dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista, a tool of U.S. imperialism and a supporter of the American mafia. Mandela earned his law degree under the racist National Party, which ruled South Africa with brutality and what they called apartheid, Afrikaans for separateness, a system of domestic colonialism that deprived all Africans of their most fundamental human rights. Both Castro and Mandela rebelled against such unjust systems and joined revolutionary movements to transform those societies. They are, therefore, the very epitome of rebel lawyers. But again, unless I'm dead wrong, I don't think there's a Fidel or a Nelson in this audience, but I'll be glad to be wrong. The next rebel lawyer is a little closer to the mark. He's Clarence Darrow, who lived during the late 19th and the early 20th centuries. He was a brilliant lawyer, a socialist, back when millions of Americans voted for socialists, and an atheist. In 1902, Darrow went to the Cook County Jail in Chicago and spoke to the prisoners there about law. Here's a little something of what he said. See what the law is. When these men, the rich, get control of things, they make the laws. They do not make the laws to protect anybody. Courts are not instruments of justice. When your case gets into court, it'll make little difference whether you are guilty or innocent, but it's better if you have a smart lawyer. And you cannot have a smart lawyer unless you have money. First and last, it's a question of money. Those people who own the earth make the laws to protect what they have. They fix up a sort of fence or pen around what they have, and they fix the law so the fellow on the outside cannot get in. The laws are really organized for the protection of the men who rule the world. They were never organized or enforced for justice. We have no system for doing justice, not the slightest in the world, unquote. Those are the words of Clarence Darrow, one of the original rebel lawyers. In September 1925, Dr. Ossian Sweet of Detroit was charged and convicted of murder after shooting at a mob of whites assembled to attack his home for being a black man who dared to move into a white area. When he was granted a retrial, Clarence Darrow took the defense case and won an acquittal. You, law students, should read the closing arguments, for you will read some of the finest arguments ever made in an American courtroom. I leave that to you if you're interested. Now, I use Darrow as a model for rebel lawyers for a reason. You, as law students, have a wealth of doors open before you. Indeed, some of you will go into prosecutors' offices and work to help build and strengthen the bulwark of mass incarceration. Why? Because the lure of power is powerful. How do you think mass incarceration came to be? Was it a mistake? No. Back during the early 1980s, neoliberals took power in major American cities and waged war on black communities, led more often than not by Democrats like Philadelphia's first black mayor, Wilson Good, who brought the infamous MOVE bombing into being. Shortly before him, D.A. Edward Rendell would join with former Mayor Frank Rizzo to give his blessing to the August 8, 1978 attack on MOVE. Several years later, Rendell would announce an end to the prevailing prison system by saying that prisons would no longer do rehabilitation. Their job, he said, was incapacitation. Thus, we saw the so-called drug war achieve hyperstatus, with neoliberals joining conservatives to enact mass incarceration on a scale the nation and world had never seen before. It should not, therefore, surprise us when we see that Pennsylvania had the highest number of juvenile lifers on earth. Bipartisanship between neoliberals and conservatives built the monster we now call mass incarceration. No so-called progressive prosecutor can or will unbuild it. That's because it took the entire system, DAs, judges, cops, defense lawyers, and prison administrators, not to mention the media, to collaborate on a monstrous project like mass incarceration. Only mass resistance can abolish mass incarceration. In other words, only a mass movement. Movements like Black Lives Matter, or, for that matter, Reb Law, movements of law students who stay engaged after they become lawyers and say no to monsters like mass incarceration and its architects. That's why it's important to make note of Darryl's early days. He began his career as a corporate lawyer and made a pretty penny representing the people he would later call the men who rule the world. But his 1894 meeting with socialist activist and leader Eugene Victor Debs was transformative. Darryl resigned from his corporate clients and, at serious financial sacrifice, began representing those who opposed the economic elites. He represented Debs at a federal espionage trial 4 years later and lost. But Darryl, socialist, anti-racist, atheist, had begun his long walk as a rebel lawyer. He opposed the death penalty and represented 100 clients facing death and never had a single one go to death row. And speaking of the death penalty, I want you to know that this isn't my first trip to Yale. For in 1991, the Yale Law Journal published my essay called Teetering on the Brink Between Life and Death. It's in volume 100. One of my lawyers was exalted, saying, "I made law review." I calmly replied, "You're right." And I didn't take a class. I thank you for inviting me back and welcome the work to come to abolish mass incarceration. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
All right, welcome to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, I'm back. That's right. Anyway, at the back end of the show, we have a packed show today, so I'm going to rush through this. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear two clips from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a new synthesis of communism, the new communism. And they're both speaking to the situation we're in today. The first will be the Democratic Party, a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. Then, on the occasion of Black History Month, we'll listen to a piece called The Oppression of Black People and Other People of Color. Both of these are excerpts from a speech Bob Avakian gave last summer, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. You should definitely check that out in addition to all that we're talking about today. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be bringing back to the show someone that I'm always looking for a way to bring him in, okay? I'm always looking for a way to get him on the show. And he's one of the busiest people I know, and he's also someone who is, it's always a remarkable experience talking with him, and his name is Dar Jamail. And he has a book called The End of ICE, and it's a look at the dangerously changed and changing world we face today as the result of the acceleration and impacts of climate change, and it's one that really kind of knocked me back when I read it. Dar, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you again. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. We're going to jump into this because, believe it or not, I'm looking at, and I'll have to trim them down, I'm looking at 21 questions, okay?
I'll box that.
No. We'll just get into it deep. But first, the title, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Let's talk about that so people can get an overall view of it.
Well, the book is, I really did my best to bring people personally and viscerally the impacts of what is happening to the planet. So I went to places like the Great Barrier Reef, the Amazon rainforest, up to near the top of Denali in Alaska, to South Florida for sea level rise, to Glacier National Park, talking about glaciers and forests and a lot of other places. And I really wanted to bring people an intimacy with the planet because I feel like the fundamental root cause of climate disruption is our disconnect from the planet, that if we were all a lot more deeply connected to the planet, we would think a lot deeper and make better decisions about how we treated the planet that we rely on for our very lives. And so I really tried to bring that into the book. And then the finding meaning part is really inevitably by the time you get to the book and, you know, anyone that has a really deep fundamental understanding of how far along we really already are regarding our impacts on the planet and what's in store for us. I really was personally confronted with, I need a new ontology. I basically need a new operating system on how am I going to live my life, you know, go through the grief and despair and then come out the other side of it and realize, okay, what does it make sense now to do given this moment that's upon us?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really got to me too is that you opened a book up with you falling into a crevice. And I thought, yikes. And there's a lot that gets concentrated in there because it actually what gets posed there is where exactly does humanity belong in relation to the world today? And I thought the way you described being down this, like, I don't know what you'd call it, like this sort of tube that was like just between you and, in, you know, endless falling was just that little bit of rope you had to hang on to with the person that was up top. And just looking at that, what you looked at in terms of seeing the ice and stuff. And I wanted you to talk about that a little bit because it was really something that very struck me very much in terms of how you look at the role, where humanity fits into things. And, well, let's talk about that.
Well, we are hanging by this rope right now, aren't we? I mean, we look at what's upon us and the climate impacts on our ability to feed ourselves on a mass scale, water availability, breathable air, you know, forest fires, parts of the earth becoming uninhabitable. Some already are, and increasingly vast amounts in the not-so-distant future will. And so we are kind of on this edge, and beneath us is this black abyss that we can't see the bottom of. And we're hanging there in this moment of time looking at, for me, in the glacier, falling into this giant crack in the glacier, I've had this time to meditate and look at this ice and understand how quickly it's all going away. That this ice that's been there for millennia because of our actions is vanishing. And we are now literally hanging by this rope of, okay, we're suspended in this moment of time. Here's what we know our actions have done. Here's what it looks like is coming projected wise. What are we going to do? You know, and it really comes down to, I think, you know, it really focuses in on the moment, what's really, really important and how do I want to use this time? Because so much right now is in the balance and so much is in flux.
Yeah, you know, and I think actually putting this book out is one of the best ways you can use your time right now, because I think it brings so much to people and so much for people to actually, one, just, you know, dig into and try and figure out, okay, what is it and why is it so important? And then figure out where they stand in relation to it and what needs to be done. And I was thinking about that in relation to, you know, you talk about the planet being rapidly changing, and what we're witnessing is unlike anything that's occurred in human history or even geologic history up until this point. Let's talk about this. Is it really that much of a leap?
We are there. I mean, we look at what's been set in motion regarding how much we've already heated the atmosphere and specifically the oceans. I mean, the oceans have absorbed 93% of all the heat that we've added into the atmosphere. That's so much energy that if they hadn't done that, our atmosphere today would be 97 degrees hotter, which, i.e., we would be well on our way to Venus. That's an extraordinary statistic. What's even more extraordinary about it is that half of that heat has been added just since 1997. So this is why the last 5 years in a row have each been a record year of how hot the oceans have become, and they keep being beaten by the next year. This is why the last 4 years in a row are the hottest 4 years ever on the planet. It's stunning, and this is because things are accelerating, and you look at all the graphs and the projections, and instead of being kind of this linear upward slope upwards, they're now, a lot of them, starting to go basically straight up. And so we are in a inevitable crisis. The last time, it hasn't been, it's been more than 50 million years since there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere. For another thing to give people geologic perspective, Dr. Harold Wadless, sea level rise expert at University of Miami, reminded me that as the Earth went in and out of the last ice age, we watched a direct correlation with sea level rise and how much CO2 was in the atmosphere. So in the past, when atmospheric CO2 increased by 100 parts per million, we saw a corresponding 100-foot sea level rise. And so I did the math in my head when I was speaking with him, and I said, so generally speaking, since the Industrial Revolution began, we've added 130 parts per million CO2 to the atmosphere. So that's a corresponding potential 130-foot sea level rise. And he just nodded. So if we're looking at that, we are looking at an irrevocably changed planet in dramatic, dramatic ways. And that leaves us in this position now of complete, utter overwhelm. And the book kind of forced this crisis upon me, because by the time I got to the last chapter, I was like, I have no idea how to end this book. And then a series of things happened that really helped me kind of come to terms with how to end it. And that's why I've really shifted from being this kind of doomsday reporter to, we are now in a moment where we have to decide, how am I going to live my life? And one of the things I bring up in the book is Western colonial mindset is this, that humans, we have rights. What are my rights? Well, an indigenous perspective is, of their ontology is really, how do I live my life so that I make the best decisions about what to do as to how it might impact future generations? And then the other part of that, how can I be of service to the planet? And so if I wake up and I'm thinking along those lines, no matter how grim and how intense our situation looks right now, and it is very much both of those, then I'm coming at it more of a perspective of how can I be of service? And then it's a lot easier to not get caught up in the overwhelm of the big picture and feeling powerless, you know, but we'll look at what the government's doing. And instead, I need to go out the door thinking, how can I help people? How can I help the planet? Because we don't know where this is going, and if I'm able to do some work that helps one other species, I have no idea what that might help in the future. I mean, that might be something that enables us all to be here a bit longer, or maybe make it through this keyhole that's rapidly approaching.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that's actually really remarkable about the way that you approach this is that, you know, you actually talk about two things that really struck me right away. And that was, like, you don't talk about climate change as much as the term anthropogenic, human caused, basically, climate change. And I wanted to ask you why. And then within that, there's also, you talk about a nuclear explosion of geologic change and the significance of that in relation to the human caused climate change.
That's right. So I use that term, anthropogenic climate disruption, because it's the most scientifically accurate way to define or describe what's happening. So we know 100% that it's human caused. We know that instead of calling it climate change, which that word change actually is a product of the fossil fuel denial industry because it kind of softens it. It's more accurate to describe it as disruption because we've not changed the climate. The climate does always change. We have fundamentally disrupted it. All I need to do is point to your wildfires, your record-breaking wildfires and droughts in California, or the Arctic vortex that just beset the Midwest and the Northeast, or these record-breaking floods and hurricanes. I mean, dot, dot, dot. We could spend the next 5 days talking about the evidence. And then as far as an explosion of geologic change, and those are words from Dr. Dan Fagry. He's a U.S. Geological Survey scientist at Glacier National Park that I featured in the Glacier chapter of my book. Because he talks about the fact, for example, Glacier National Park, just before it was designated National Park, this place had 158 glaciers. Today there's 14. Hmm. Back then there was 150 square kilometers of ice coverage in the park. Today it's less than 15. And he said, look, Glacier National Park is not going to have any active glaciers by 2030. That's 11 years from now. And that's at current trajectories, assuming things don't keep speeding up, which things continue to speed up every year. So it's going to probably be in advance of 2030 that Glacier National Park will not have glaciers. And that's just really a good analogy that we could kind of, take and insert in a lot of these other aspects of what's happening around the planet. And so when he talks about the speed with which this is happening, just like I talked about, the speed with which we've added this heat into the oceans, it is a change that's happening equivalent, as his analogy, a nuclear explosion of geologic change, because it's instantaneous. I mean, we're looking at change that's happening on a human timescale, change that should be taking place, if it's taking place at all, over geologic time, i.e. millennia, and instead we're talking about it in decades and sometimes even single-digit years.
Boy, one of the things that you dig into deeply, and I have to say it is one of the things that when I read it, it immediately sort of put things on a different level than maybe I've been. And I'm not somebody who's actually been ignorant of what's happening with the climate, but I thought actually the way that you concentrated on greenhouse gas emissions and the thawing of the subsea permafrost in the Arctic and the possibility of a methane burp and catastrophic consequences, which then opened up a window to me for what, all the other things that would come in the wake of that.
That's right. So, I dedicated an entire chapter, and in fact, it's the second to last chapter and kind of sets the stage for the conclusion, which where I get into a lot of dealing with grief and needing a new kind of philosophy and perspective on how to live our lives at this moment, and because it really forced the issue. And what it is, talking about the terrestrial permafrost, I interviewed one of the leading experts on this subject out of University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he's been studying it around the world for decades. And he said, look, it's thawing out dramatically, that basically almost all the permafrost in Alaska will be hitting 0 degrees, which means the surface of it will all be, irretrievably thawing well before 2100. That's what we're on track for right now. And stored within the terrestrial permafrost is a massive amount of organic material. So as that warms and thaws, it is releasing that CO2, and so there is some methane in there too, into the atmosphere. So that's a feedback loop. And then as the atmosphere continues to warm and as the oceans continue to warm, as we just talked about how fast that's happening, in the subsea permafrost, there's methane hydrates frozen into it, and that methane is already being released. And I outline that in the book under the threat of a giant cataclysmic release of a massive amount of that coming out all at once, as Natalia Shikova has written a peer-reviewed scientific study about, which a 50-gigaton burst, which would be the CO2 equivalent of roughly two-thirds of the total amount of CO2 we've added into the atmosphere to date, but happening abruptly, happening essentially all at once. And the abrupt temperature shifts that would cause of warming on the planet are, this is where we get into the realm of science fiction movie material, but it's something that, according to her, could already happen at any moment. So these are extremely troubling scientific facts that we're looking at. And we look at what's happened over the Arctic just over the last summer. We already have lakes of on top of the permafrost, the terrestrial permafrost, that already the subsurface permafrost there is thawing out to the point where you have lakes that look like they're bubbling because methane is coming up from underneath them. Dr. Ira Leifer, who I interviewed in the book, talks about methane, huge areas of methane that are already being released in different areas of the shallow seabeds up in the Arctic. So, you know, this is extremely disconcerting. I mean, methane is a 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 on a 10-year time scale. So when we start talking about methane, this is why one of the NASA reports that I cited several times in my book, they referred to methane as kind of the sleeping giant or the ticking time bomb. And they're also very, very concerned about what they're seeing in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that also is, and again, I mean, there's just so much, reading this book has just been an eye-opener. And I'm not somebody who's been, you know, sort of like, you know, having a blinders over my eyes in terms of what's going on in the world, and in particular in relation to the environment and the status of the planet. At the same time, I'm also not a person who actually took the time and thought, okay, and this is something that really got me. Even if we stop all greenhouse gas emissions, it would take 25,000 years for most of what is currently in the atmosphere to be absorbed by the oceans. Now, this raises a question because you're talking 25,000 years, and boy, there's not a lot of room there for actually, you know, it seems like it's almost sort of like this is a foregone conclusion, and it would take 25,000 years to actually get rid of what's currently in the atmosphere for that to be absorbed by the oceans. So there has to be something else done, and that to me is what brings in the human side and what people can bring to this in terms of trying to change this.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's why I, you know, really was led myself. I mean, writing this book, Michael, changed my life. I mean, I really went from a place of being so cynical and pessimistic. I mean, connecting all these dots, it's utterly overwhelming, and I, too, was fraught with despair and depression at times and trying to figure out, well, what the hell do I do? What the hell does it mean to even try to do anything at this point when you put all this together? But that's when, you know, you inevitably have to kind of look more deeply. I did, and really find a place. Okay, well, what does it mean? And that's why I subtitled the book as I did, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, because it forces us to get really kind of down, it forced me to kind of get down on my knees and like, okay, what am I going to do? And you know, really, whatever my philosophy is or my spirituality might be, it's time to dig deep. And for me, really, I can't even take full responsibility in the last chapter for how things panned out, because I was right working on my final edits days before my final deadline of the manuscript. And all of a sudden, I met Stan Rushworth, who's in the book, and I quote him, and he brought me several indigenous stories, a couple of which are in the book. And it really helped me kind of find my way and kind of come into this indigenous perspective of, look, my current meaning now when I get up is, how can I serve this planet? Because we don't know. We've never been here. We are in an unprecedented time for our species. All of a sudden, we may not have a future, but nothing is guaranteed and nothing is certain. And so it behooves me, and I hope as many people as possible, once we really understand the gravity of this crisis, to start thinking about, how can I serve the planet, and what actions do I need to take to try to help future generations? What can I do to possibly enable some more species to exist that otherwise might not exist? What can I do to try to make this place a little bit better so that maybe there is still a chance for us to be here in the future? And because since we've not been here before, we don't know for sure how all this is going to play out. And even if it is, even if we are doomed, even if, you know, it does come to pass that, you know, okay, there's no way out of this. We've already, you know, crossed too many thresholds. Again, how do we want to live? How do we want to go out? Do I want to go out on my feet? Do I want to live a meaningful life where I'm serving other people and serving the planet and still doing the right thing? And to me, I feel like I have a moral obligation, no matter what, to do that, because mm-hmm. that's simply how I want to live my life today.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamil about his new book, which is a really important book, folks. I can't recommend it enough. It's just it's something that will blow your mind, but it'll also open your eyes in a lot of ways. And it's called The End of Ice, and it's by Dar Jamil. And it is a tremendous book. And Dar, let's get back on. We have a few more questions for you. You know, you talk about this, and this is, I mean, I do have to say that this is one of the, you know, it's remarkable, because when you're talking about all this, and I kept thinking that this, you can look at one, a lot of times people will look at one factor and then say, okay, I understand this, or I look at another factor and understand this. But you kind of are forced, you're forced to bring in, or you do bring in, you force people in a way by reading what you've written to deal with this thing in terms of that there's the sense overall that there are dramatic changes in the highest and cold places, as well as there's places that are being just overrun with, you know, melting whatever, what, you know, high water coming in, and, you know, in places around in the South Seas and stuff. And there's a real crisis here that people need a sense of the overall dramatic changes, both in the highest and coldest places, as well as in the places that actually always are put forward in the movies as this is paradise. Nothing bad ever happens here.
That's right. And, you know, I really tried to kind of cover the all of the perspectives from sea level rise to what's happening in the Amazon, to what's happening underwater with the coral and marine species, to even the heights of Denali and forests and, you know, everything else. And to really kind of underscore that this is impacting all of us as we speak. I mean, it's very easy to look at, you know, you folks down in Southern California and the monstrous wildfires there, you know, and it's very easy for to look at Paradise, California, and poor people who lost their lives or their homes and everything that belonged to them. You know, their entire lives were incinerated. They're already living in it. You don't need to explain to these people that climate change is real and it's impacting us dramatically. You don't need to explain to people in Houston who were flooded out by Hurricane Harvey the other summer. You don't need to explain to people in Bangladesh living on the Delta and having to relocate because of sea level rise and storms and erosion, or the thousands of people around the world daily that are already struggling for enough food and water because of climate impacts. And so, but even those of us in the West that are still in a bubble where we have shelter, we have enough money for food and water, and think, okay, well, it's not here yet, we're already breathing it in with every breath we take. You know, we've already, the CO2 is in the atmosphere, it's in us. It's already changing all the systems we rely upon to keep us alive. It's already changing the lives of virtually every other species on the planet. So I really try to bring that out in the book, that we are all in this together, and whatever decisions we make and actions we take, no matter how seemingly small, have a direct impact on ourselves and everything around us.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very heavy, because I'm, again, as I said, I'm going to have you back, man, because I'm looking at this and I have so many questions here. And one of the things is, you know, and I think people, a lot of times, there's this sort of like just thing that people have taken up and, you know, sort of picked out, and they heard it said somewhere and they just started using that as their mantra in terms of how to react. But you make a point that we cannot, no matter what people think, you know, and it goes along with what you were talking about, the world's poorest and oftentimes fastest growing regions that end up being the least equipped to deal with climate disruptions. But then you say that, look, it's not a matter of people making decisions about what they're going to allow and what they're not going to allow, although it is in a certain sense of whether they fight or not. But you can't manage. There's no way to sort of, okay, we got what we got. Now we can manage the climate back to what it is. There seems to me, you seem to be making an argument that we need to do something much more dramatic in relation to the overall situation than just saying, let's see if we can manage the climate back.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the thing that folks are left with from reading the book, and certainly the place where the book brought me, is that, again, I have to, for my own, I think, psychological well-being and mental and spiritual well-being at this point, is I can't afford to look at that big picture. I mean, I still do. You look at what's happening politically, and, you know, there's nothing to indicate that governments anywhere in the world, and I, including in Europe, are coming close to taking the dramatic measures that have to be taken to mitigate this crisis. I mean, we know it's common knowledge now that we're not going to stop it. And even 10 years ago, saying that, you would have been called a doomer or an extremist. But now, even in the corporate media, they acknowledge we're not going to stop it. Maybe we can mitigate it. How are we going to mitigate it? And there's nothing to indicate that on a grand scale that even that's going to happen at all. And so we are off the cliff, and we are going, you know, further down that precipice as, you know, each passing day, 40 billion tons of CO2 is being added into the atmosphere still every year as we speak. Nothing to indicate that this is going to change. So it inevitably brings us to this kind of personal
psychological and philosophical crisis point where I have to accept what's going on, that we live on a permanently changed planet. It's only going to intensify with each passing day. All of the science is showing this, and all of objective, measurable reality right in front of our eyes is showing this. So again, it comes back to the risk of sounding like a broken record. How then shall I live? You know, and so this is really where my own personal work, even literally just this week, and you know, the book's only been out a few weeks, and I've had to make adjustments in my own work life about what I want to work on and write about and focus my attention. And it's all going to come down to service. You know, how can I better position myself to be of service to the planet? Because I feel like at this point, personally, we have enough data. We know where we're at on the climate front. It's all out there. Anyone that really wants to know where we are, you know, this information's been out there. Me and, you know, hundreds of other journalists around the world have been writing about this for years, some a whole lot longer than me. We have the data. So now the question is, what do we each personally want to do? If we live in a country where our government is, instead of trying to actively mitigate the crisis, they're stomping on the gas pedal, which is our search situation, what can I do in my personal life and then perhaps locally or in the community where I live, and just keep my focus on that? Because positive change can be made there. And again, it comes down to me consistently have to let go of results. I have no control over them anyway, and I can't directly control my government. But if I live my personal life the right way, certainly right in my immediate vicinity, I can walk a lot more softly on the earth and try to find other ways to be of service to it and help other people.
Although, Dar, I would say, listen, give me a call, and we can both go out there and we can walk up and kick the butt of the system that's doing this. All right, we need to do something then. But I want to thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a remarkable book, and I really enjoyed talking with you. And we need to have you back soon, man, to get into more of this, because I have, believe it or not, I have about 40 questions for you. So.
Well, let's do it, Michael. It's always a real pleasure to be on your show, and great. Yeah, there's plenty more to talk about.
All right, Dar, thank you very much. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Sure. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with journalist and author Dar Jamail. His book, The End of Ice, is a look at the dangerously changed and changing world we face as the result of the accelerating impacts of climate change. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. All right, we're going to real quick jump into this next one because it's very important. I don't want to shortchange it at all. All right, we're going to be featuring now. We're going to be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a new synthesis of communism, the new communism. And this clip is called "The Democratic Party, a Major Instrument of This Monstrously Oppressive System," from the talk given last year, "Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution." And believe me, sisters and brothers, if you were watching what went down with the other night with the Republicans and the Democrats, you need to listen to this very closely, okay? So we're going to go into that, and we'll be back in just a little bit.
From everything that has been said so far, it should be clear why the fundamental change that is needed cannot be brought about by voting. Of course, those who care about and are determined to do something about oppression and injustice are constantly bombarded with the notion that it is crucial to vote for the Democrats because at least they sometimes say they care about this. And this has become all the more intense and insistent with the rise to power of the Trump-Pence fascist regime and its backing by the politicians of the Republican Party, which has itself become a fascist party at its core. It is crucial to vote for the Democrats, they tell us, in order to do something to limit the harm Trump can do. The leaders of the Democratic Party refuse to say that Trump should be removed from office now. And they insist that even talking about that only plays into Trump's hands. But because of the way the electoral system has been set up from the beginning of this country, with the Electoral College instead of direct popular election of the presidents, and small states having as many senators as states with much larger populations, all of which, by the way, was part of the compromise with the slave states, and which represents today the continuing legacy of slavery. And with the way elections for Congress have been manipulated through suppression of the votes of especially black people and Latinos, as well as the gerrymandering of districts, that is, structuring them in ways that are geographically distorted, so that people who intend to vote against the Republicans are concentrated in a few voting districts, while those, especially conservative white people, who would vote Republican are spread out through a number of such districts, giving them a greater disproportionate number of congressional representatives. Because of all this, it is far from certain that in the upcoming midterm elections, the Democratic Party will be able to pull off its blue wave to regain a majority in Congress. And what is the approach of the Democrats in attempting to achieve this? To a large degree, it is to run candidates and campaigns they hope will appeal to Trump voters, including candidates who boast of their service in the U.S. military, carrying out bombing raids and other devastation in the Middle East and Afghanistan. The truth is that not only is it necessary to overthrow the system in order to put an end to what is concentrated in the five stops and the horrific conditions to which the masses of humanity are subjected in a world dominated by this system of capitalism and imperialism, but even short of revolution, even in order to prevent the Trump-Pence regime from further consolidating its rule and more fully implementing its fascist program, it is necessary to rely not on the Democratic Party, but on masses of people, breaking out of the confines of politics as usual and carrying out sustained, nonviolent mass mobilization to drive out this fascist regime. In fact, a major role of the Democratic Party is corralling and domesticating dissent. For example, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, when there was a massive outpouring of opposition to that war, the Democratic Party as such was not in a position to co-opt and derail this dissent because, with some exceptions, Democrats in Congress voted for this war. So they utilized the organization Move On as a kind of oppositional force whose main role was to lure people who were alienated by the war and by the Democratic Party's support for the war back into politics as usual, back into the framework and confines that had produced that war in the first place. More recently, the Democratic Party and those aligned with it have done the same thing with regard to the anger and disgust that literally tens of millions feel toward Trump. And in some ways, the Democrats have actually positioned themselves to the right of Trump, especially in their insistence that the basic problem with Trump is that he is undermining America's dominant position in the world, when in reality, the America First actions of the Trump-Pence regime are aimed at increasing that domination in ways that represent a grave threat to humanity. In case there were a need for further evidence of what the Democratic Party is really about, here are two other striking examples. At the Democratic Party convention in 2016, former CIA head Leon Panetta and Marine General John Allen, a former commander of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, were featured speakers. And when some people at the convention responded by chanting, "No more war," they were met by attempts of the convention officials to silence them, and then they were drowned out by the mainstream of the Democratic Party delegates bellowing, USA! 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 And it's just as ugly as that. And let's not forget that when black youth in Baltimore rose up in righteous rebellion after the police murdered Freddie Gray, Barack Obama denounced these youth as thugs. But he never denounced the police who killed Freddie Gray as murdering thugs. I could go on and on. There is more than a mountain of evidence that shows the actual nature and role of the Democratic Party as a major instrument of this monstrously oppressive system. But there is an even more basic problem. The truth is that the governing politicians, the owners and operatives of the multi-billion-dollar media of various kinds, and others who sit atop the major institutions of this society are the political and cultural representatives of this system. Just listen to them when they talk about the role of the U.S. empire in the world. It is our interests, our military, our allies, and on and on and on. And the deeper truth is that it would be impossible for them to be anything other than representatives and functionaries of this system. This is why even stubborn efforts by well-intentioned people to turn the Democratic Party into a positive force are bound to fail. Once again, we are back to the economic relations and the operation of the economic system, the social relations bound up with this, and how this determines the character of the political system and the dominant culture. If the political system operated in conflict with these underlying relations, the society could not function. For this fundamental reason, political parties, which have a major role and influence in this society, are and could only be ruling class parties. Representatives of the ruling capitalist class, instruments of this system of ruthless oppression, administrators and enforcers of a worldwide empire of exploitation and plunder, responsible for massive destruction and devastation of countries and people, and posing a very real and growing threat to the very existence of humanity through environmental destruction or nuclear annihilation.
All right, welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show. That was Bob Avakian. It was a clip called "The Democratic Party, a Major Instrument of This Monstrously Oppressive System," from the talk given last year, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And it's the Michael Slate Show. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That's a Douglas Street Shuffle, and that's just enough to get every muscle in my body moving today, okay? I just love that song, and I hope you like it too. All right, I just want to make a few comments here before we jump into our next segment. You know, as people know, we had the segment on the Democrats because a lot of people are looking to the Democrats as somehow they're going to stand up and save things. Just not going to happen. They are part of this system. They are part of the oppressive imperial system and what it does to people all over the world. They're just as responsible for what's happening in the world as the Republicans. And these are forces that we need to stand up against. And what you're going to be listening to next is the oppression of black people and other people of color. And this is an excerpt that's taken from the speech, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Now think about this, sisters and brothers. Do we need an actual revolution? From the very founding of this country, black people have been held in chains, tortured, murdered, their children stolen from them, sold in markets. You know, think about what it's meant for black people and their survival as a people. They faced horrors on top of horrors from day one. And now the Trump-Pence regime is proceeding to ram into place a fully fascist form of rule, which is going to have as one of its main targets black people and other oppressed people of color. This is not a time for celebration. It's a time to fight for an actual revolution to emancipate all humanity and end the oppression of black people and all people.
The oppression of black people and other people of color. This system in this country was founded in genocide and slavery. From the beginning, African Americans and Native Americans were treated as pariahs, a caste of people less than human and not deserving of the same rights and opportunities as the European settlers of the territory. White supremacy was poured into the foundation and into every institution of the country. The uniting of the United States was accomplished through the compromise written into the founding Constitution that institutionalized slavery. And for generations, slave labor produced a great part of the wealth of this country. As I said in Basics 1-1, there would be no United States as we now know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth. And then, when it was no longer possible to contain the conflicts that had been somewhat held in check by the founding compromise, the Civil War erupted between the southern slave states and the northern states, which increasingly were based on the exploitation of wage labor by capitalists. But shortly after the end of this civil war, another compromise was engineered, which was a continuation of the original compromise under the new conditions. The country was put back together on the basis of reaffirming and reinforcing white supremacy. With the masses of black people still overwhelmingly in the South, subjugated and terrorized into second-class citizen status, exploited in conditions of near slavery and sometimes still literal slavery by white plantation and other property owners. And the land and way of life of the native peoples was further stolen through armed conquest and decimated by slaughter, confinement in reservations, and cultural genocide, which has resulted in the poverty, oppression, and repression that continues to be inflicted on Native Americans to this day. Under slavery, it was the armed patrols and militias organized by the slave owners that hunted down slaves who rebelled or just tried to escape and terrorized the masses of black people as a whole. After slavery, with Jim Crow segregation, it was the Ku Klux Klan, together with local sheriffs, who largely played this role. Today, in the conditions in which masses of black people in the ghettos of the inner cities find themselves, the role that was played in the past by the slave patrols and then the Ku Klux Klan and local sheriffs is now carried out by heavily armed urban police forces. This is a big part of the overall role of the police, which, as I said in Basics 124, is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness. In the days of slavery and then Jim Crow segregation after the Civil War, the oppressors viciously exploited and terrorized black people, brutally murdering those they saw as posing a threat or not staying in their place. But they did not kill off or incarcerate a huge part of the black population because their labor was needed as a backbone and crucial source of profit for the cotton plantations and the overall economy in the South and the country as a whole. Today, with great numbers of black people concentrated in the inner cities, and with many factories and other capitalist enterprises having moved away from the urban cores, the police have killed thousands of black people in the last few decades, and they play a key part in forcibly maintaining masses of black people in a situation where, especially youth, robbed of any decent future under this system, are killing each other in the thousands, and millions are either incarcerated or in some other way under the control of the so-called justice system. Because white supremacy is such a defining part of this country, it is not just African Americans and Native Americans, but people of color generally who are subjected to discrimination, degradation, and brutality. And this applies now in acute ways to those whose roots lie in Mexico, El Salvador, and other parts of Central America and the Caribbean, which are tightly ensnared in a net of domination and exploitation by the imperialists of the USA, whose ravaging of these countries has driven many to emigrate to the U.S. itself. White supremacy and capitalism, they have been completely interwoven and tightly stitched together through the whole development of this country down to today. To attempt to really put an end to white supremacy while maintaining the system of capitalism would tear the entire fabric of the country apart. White supremacy and capitalism. It is not possible to overcome and finally abolish the one without overthrowing and finally abolishing the other.
Again, that was Bob Avakian talking about the oppression of black people and other people of color. And it's an excerpt taken from the piece, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And you can access that exactly at revcom.us. All right, what I want to do now is I want to read you something. And it's a piece from the Revolutionary Communist Party about the oppression of black people in this country. Now, this is something a little bit out of the ordinary in terms of the way that we're doing this, but I think it's really that important that people should hear this, discuss it with their friends, spread it around, and write back to me if you have any comments on it and you want to engage in some conversation or get it out to your friends. So with that short introduction, let me read this to you. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Bull. This system has enslaved, brutalized, tortured, and betrayed black people for 400 years. We need an actual revolution to emancipate all humanity. There is the potential for something of unprecedented beauty to arise out of unspeakable ugliness. Black people playing a crucial role in putting an end, at long last, to this system which has, for so long, not just exploited but dehumanized, terrorized, and tormented them in a thousand ways. Putting an end to this in the only way it can be done, by fighting to emancipate humanity, to put an end to the long night in which human society has been divided into masters and slaves, and the masses of humanity have been lashed, beaten, raped, slaughtered, shackled, and shrouded in ignorance and misery. That's a quote from Bob Avakian, the leader of the revolution. the most important and urgent truth demonstrated by the history of black people in America. And this is from the Revolution Club in New York City. If ever a history brings out in vivid color that where there is oppression, there will be resistance. It is the history of black people in America, a history of over 400 years of the most vicious, brutal, and cruel oppression, from slavery through Jim Crow lynchings and segregation to today's mass incarceration, police murder, and brutality, with an open white supremacist back in the White House, and a history of heroic resistance and rebellion that has rocked this system on its heels and inspired people the world over, from slave rebellions to the civil rights movement and black liberation struggles to today's fights against police terror and mass incarceration. And if it was just a question of courage, of determination, and of sacrifice, black people and many oppressed people all over the world would be liberated by now. But the most important and urgent truth demonstrated by this history is this. Without the necessary scientific theory and leadership, the struggle of the oppressed will be contained and remain confined within the system which is the source of oppression. And the horrors to which the masses are subjected will go on and on. We have seen this too with the struggle against the oppression of black people repeatedly being misled, betrayed, and channeled back into the confines of the very system that is the source of this oppression. But today, this is no longer necessary. Today, we have the scientific theory and leadership we need to get free in the new communism forged by and the ongoing work of Bob Avakian, B.A. B.A. has developed the science, the strategy, and the vision and concrete plan for a real revolution and a radically new society on the road to full emancipation. As part of this, B.A. has shown how white supremacy and capitalism, they have been completely interwoven and tightly stitched together through the whole development of this country down to today, to attempt to really put an end to white supremacy while maintaining the system of capitalism would tear the entire fabric of the country apart. Indeed, only a real revolution can put an end to this nightmare. Right now, those who catch the worst hell under this system and those who are sickened by the endless outrages perpetrated by this system need to join up with this revolution. Thousands need to get organized into the ranks of the revolution now, while millions are being influenced in favor of this revolution. You think you are woke, but you are sleepwalking through a nightmare. We need an actual revolution to emancipate all humanity. Let go of the vicious notion that getting black faces at the top of this system of global plunder and exploitation will change anything meaningful for the masses of people here and worldwide, when history has shown time and again exactly the opposite. Stop getting played by basing who to listen to or follow on someone's identity, rather than critically evaluating the objective content of what they have to say and what it will mean for humanity's future. Cast aside the paltry notion of black people striving to compete on the terms of this dog-eat-dog system through black capitalism and black entrepreneurship. And it's time for oppressed people to get off their knees and stop praying to a non-existent God to come down and save them. Like B.A. says, let's call this what it is. It is a slave mentality with which people are being indoctrinated. All this, thank you, Jesus, is a slave mentality. And one last thing to white people specifically, as well as others who are not black. There is no excuse for sitting this fight out, even under the BS guise of staying in your lane or acting merely as an ally. All of us, of every nationality, bear full responsibility for ending this oppression by taking up this struggle, scientifically digging into the cause of the problem and solution, and acting on that understanding as part of emancipating all of humanity. If you are ready to stop getting played and get on the road to real emancipation, you need to get into the science, the strategy, and the leadership we have to make the revolution we need. Where to start? Go to revcom.us and watch the film of the speech from Bob Avakian, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Go every day to revcom.us, the voice of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Join the Revolution Club to start fighting for this revolution as you learn more about it. The chance to defeat them when the time comes, the chance to be rid of this system and to bring something far better into being has everything to do with what we do now. Everyone who hungers for a radically different world, free of exploitation and oppression, and all the needless suffering caused by this system, needs to work now with a fired determination to make this happen, so we will have a real chance to win. Humanity needs revolution and the new communism. Fight the power and transform the people for revolution. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank Dar Jamail, and again, check out his book, The End of ICE. And thanks to Bob Avakian for the speech we excerpted here, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And remember, you can access all of that at revcom.us, R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M as in Michael, .us. And I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. You can write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with The Voice of Revolution by Savage Rose. Talk to you again next week.